Hello, this is Joe Crump.
Hey, Joe.
Who's on the line there?
Hey,
how's it going? I am going. What I'm going to do first is I'm going to put everybody on mute. So,
thank you, Joe.
Okay.
Conference muted.
All righty. Everybody's on mute now. And this conference line, this is a new one for me, so I'm still kind of testing it. But in theory, the way it's supposed to work is if you have a question for me, you can raise your hand over the phone line by pressing 5-star. And it'll throw a little icon up on my screen, theoretically, and I'll be able to click unmute you specifically and be able to talk to you specifically. So that way we don't have to listen to all the noise in the background and all the chatter that typically goes along with a call that's got this many people on it. So I guess, and I know that a few of you have actually asked questions by email, and what I'm going to try to do is remember to get back to those, but I think that if you'll just raise your hand like everybody else, and when I get to you, tell me you sent me the email, and we'll go to that email and ask that question. So you can go ahead and press 5-star. Nobody else will hear you but you, and it'll put you put your name up there or your phone number, I guess. I don't really have your names. It just has your phone numbers next to it. And then we'll answer some questions. Alrighty. Okay, I'm going to unmute the first one here, if I can. And this is the area code on this one is 732. Who have I got on me?
That's Jerome from New Jersey, Joe. How you doing?
Hey, Jerome. How's it going?
Oh, Joe, I don't know. I was waiting for this call so I can get some your advice about this seller. Now, the seller, you know, I went with the for rent method.
Oh, let me stop you just 1 second. For those of you others that have pressed the 5-star thing to raise your hands, it's okay. Just hang in there, and then as I finish with Jerome, I'll go to the next one and the next one and the next one, and hopefully we'll get to everybody's questions here over the next couple hours. Anyway, sorry, Jerome. Go ahead.
That's okay. Yes, using the for rent method, contacted a seller, met with her. She signed the one page lease option agreement memo. She's a realtor. She had her sign in the yard. I put my sign in front of hers, and I started getting calls. I must have showed the house maybe 3 or 4 times, and I got someone who's ready to pull the trigger. Now, when I called her to let her know, she said to me that she wanted escrow money. She wanted $6,200 in escrow money. That's above and beyond what I told her that what my fee is. I said, you know, I charge $5,000 in non-refundable lease option fee, and I said I'll give you 1 month's rent out of that. So technically, or theoretically, I would be only making $3,500 on the deal as opposed to the whole $5,000. And now she says that she wants the escrow money. And then when I called my buyer, then she told me that she contacted the owner. The owner reduced the price, and it's like now it's like she's trying to cut me out of the deal.
Yeah. When the buyers start talking to the sellers, they're going to try to cut you out of the deal.
Okay.
Really quickly. And that may be where this extra money is coming from. So part of this has to do, first of all, I'm sorry this is happening to you because you're probably not going to get this deal done.
Right, okay.
They're probably going to stab you right in the back.
Mm-hmm.
But you might be able to still put it together, but what I would do for the future in this situation is to have a conversation with your seller before you start this process. And I was talking about this, and I just got off a call with the rest of the mentor group, and somebody else was having something similar to this where the seller was ripping them off. So if you have a conversation in advance, and you set expectations up front, and you help them understand how the deal works and what's going on, and get them to say, yes, I will do it that way. So
okay.
if they've signed the lease option agreement memo with you, because they said, I'll do it for this amount of years, they wrote that in there, right?
Mm-hmm.
They said they'll do it for this price. They didn't ask for any lease option fee or deposit up front.
No.
And that was all clear. So what I would do is go through them and say, You know, I call this lease option memo the stab me in the back contract. Because what it does is it allows you to stab me in the back, to completely rip me off, you know, to just put the screws to me.
Right.
And I do that because, first of all, I believe that most people are not going to rip me off. Most people are not going to steal from me. Most people are not going to cheat me out of what I bring to the table. And I feel that, you know, just by talking to you, I can tell that you're not one of those people either. Use those words, you know, about stabbing me in the back, of ripping me off, of cheating me. Use those words so that she'll know in the future that if she does that, that's what she's done.
Mm-hmm.
Say, I'm gonna go to work for you. I'm gonna spend time, effort, and my money, and I'm gonna put somebody into this property to solve the problem that you've got right now of being able to have to make that payment.
Mm-hmm.
We're gonna get somebody good in there who's gonna want to buy that property from you.
Right.
That's what you want, right?
Right.
Okay. And for me to do that, the way I get paid is you don't have to pay me a dime. I'm getting paid by the buyer, but I'm going to ask you to when I bring a buyer, to not go around me. Is that fair enough? This sets expectations on a pretty high level.
Right.
And it also gets them to say it out loud that they're not going to rip you off. What they're going to do is look for a way to rip you off and feel good about it. They're going to look for a way that why they shouldn't have trusted you. Well, he's just trying to do this or do that, or he didn't do what he was supposed to do. They're going to look for those things. So when you set expectations about what you are going to do and what you expect from them and what they can expect from you, it's going to make it easier for you to put that deal together without getting stabbed in the back.
Okay.
And because it sounds to me like that's where this is going.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I would have the same conversation right now with that lady and with your buyer.
Right.
Say, here's the situation, you know. I wrote this contract with you under these agreements, under these terms. And she's a realtor, by the way.
Yes.
So what she's doing is acting unethically.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there is I don't know that I would outright threaten her at the beginning. but I think that at some point I would say, you know, I think the board would really frown on the way you're doing business here. Yeah, you're doing things that are unethical.
Mm-hmm.
And when you start to say that to a realtor, it makes them really nervous because they can lose their license.
Wow.
If you report them, they've got to go through a whole process of proving they didn't do anything wrong. Now, on the other hand, they can create problems for you if you report them. So I'm not suggesting that you report them.
Mm-hmm.
But making a subtle hint or threat that you would, and only if this situation happens,
right.
then I think that you would be justified in doing so. Remember that, you know, without having a real estate agent's license, if you try to represent buyers in a transaction without being a principal, you're breaking the law.
Right.
That's why we have to have a lease option memo. That's why you've got that.
Mm-hmm.
But most agents won't understand the concept of being a principal, even though it's on their test that they have to take. Every broker's test talks about being a principal in a transaction, giving you the right to sell your own property without a license. Which is, but a lot of them don't remember that.
Okay.
And then they'll say, well, you're trying to sell property without having a license. You know, that's against the law. I said, no, it's not. I'm a principal in the transaction. Read your license law, you know, because that's what it says. And any real estate attorney will back me up on this. But that doesn't mean that they can't go complain to the board of realtors and create some problems for you.
Mm-hmm.
Because then you have to defend yourself, and you don't want to have to get into that situation. So you're better off at the beginning probably not dealing with realtors at all.
Okay. But you know what? She had it. She's a realtor and an investor, and she had a house listed on Zillow, and you know, that's where I picked it up at. When I called her, you know, I went over and met her, talked to her, and all that kind of thing. And I mean, the house was vacant and everything. She gave me lockbox keys and the whole nine. I thought she was really, you know, going to sit back and let me do what we do.
Right.
But
right.
I called my buyer, and she was like, well, you know, I spoke to the owner and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and now she cut the deal. She dropped the asking because she was asking $214,900.
Right.
Now, and I said, well, and I told my buyer, I told the buyer the price, the asking price is $219,900 because this is where I get my money, because she's not, I'm not charging the, I didn't tell the, my buyer, but the owner, she's, you know, she doesn't pay me anything, and she knocked it down to $204,000.
Right.
From $209,000 to $204,000, so she just sort of knocked me right out the ballpark. Now, I can't go back to the buyer and say, you know, the price is $214,000 again. You know what I mean?
I think you potentially can talk to your seller and make them, first of all, feel guilty for ripping you off. And if you can't accomplish that, at least make them nervous that you're going to report them to the ethics committee at the Board of Realtors. Because what she's done, in my opinion, is a tremendous breach of ethics. And I don't know whether the board would see it the same way or not. And I'm not advocating that you actually do it.
Right, right.
But the threat of it itself may be something to help you on this. And once again, it goes back to the idea of building trust, having people follow through with you. And sometimes somebody's going to try to rip you off. That's why you don't ever let your buyer and seller get together.
Right.
That's why you don't like to have your sign and her sign in the front yard. That completely sucks, and you don't want to do that.
Right.
When you put your sign in the yard, you pull hers out. And you make sure you get permission. Otherwise, she's going to be angry with you.
Right.
But you pull hers out, and yours is in there instead. If she won't let you do that, then you don't go up head-to-head against her. Say, if you're going to market this, that's fine. You know, let me know when you're done. And then I'll come in, and I'll take over. Because I can get it filled much quicker than you because of the resources that I have.
Right.
You know, because I've got these online sources, you know, these proprietary, you use that great word, proprietary online sources that will bring in buyers for this specifically. Plus, I've got a list of, how many people you got on your list right now?
I got over 500 people on my list.
Yeah, I mean, plus I got 500 lease option buyers on my list right now that are interested in buying in this, this area. So I've got people, I can fill this property pretty quickly. More quickly than you. If you want to do it yourself, as long as you want to do it yourself, that's fine. But until you're ready to let me market it and do the things that I do to sell it to my list and work with me, then it makes sense for you to go ahead and do it on your own. When you get tired of that or get tired of making the payments on it, then you come to me and I'll take care of it for you. And remember these famous words. I know you've heard me say them hundreds of times. This is how I work.
Right.
This is the way I do business. You know, nobody else has their sign in the yard but me. If you let that happen, because I understand at the beginning you kind of want to negotiate with people and you kind of want, you feel like, well, I'm not that good at it yet and I should negotiate. And maybe you should, and maybe you should take a chance. But when you do take a chance like that, it means that these things are going to happen. And the next time you do it, my guess is, you're going to say to yourself, I'll be damned if I let somebody else have a sign in the yard next to mine and take those calls that I'm getting, because they're going to call both those signs.
Right.
And they're going to call
that. That's right. And then you create confusion amongst the potential buyers.
Exactly. And there's two different prices, and they're obviously going to take the lower price.
Because she had the MLS listings, like on the counter, the kitchen counter, and I would, every time I go in there, I would get in there before my buyers. And I would take it out, put it on top of the cabinets.
Right.
So this way, it's obscured. And so, this was definitely a learning experience. And moving forward, if there's a sign, I'm going to ask the owner. Would it be if I take remove your sign and put my sign, because I potentially can fill the house quicker than you can.
Exactly.
You know, like that. Wow. It's learning experience. I was a little ticked off, Joe, but. We go in there with a, like I said, and I tell them, non-threatening, non-binding, stab me in the back contract.
Right.
And I says, you certainly have the right to market your own property, but if I bring a buyer first, then, that's basically what she said. So in other words, what she did, she used my buyer to her advantage. That's what she did.
She ripped you off.
Yep.
She's stealing from you. You need to make sure she understands that.
Yeah.
You need to make sure that she understands that you believe that she's breached her ethics, her realtor ethics, because they have to sign a ethics agreement to be a realtor.
Right.
And you can report her. But at first I would get her to comply. Before I started threatening her, I'd get her to comply, and then I'd just keep pushing a little bit harder. And, next time, what will you do different?
Next time I won't market that area.
You won't
because it's almost like a 40-minute drive.
It's not the area. You can do it in a different state if you want to, a different country.
Okay,
that's not the issue.
Okay.
That wasn't the problem.
Right.
What was the problem?
I guess my approach to her, I wasn't convincing enough.
That was part of it, but there was a bigger problem. You let the buyer and seller get together.
Yes, I let the buyer and seller get together.
And that happened because the sign in the yard.
Right.
Otherwise, they wouldn't have gotten together.
Exactly.
And the MLS listing, and you might want to stay away from listed properties for now. There's a point where they actually make sense to do listed properties.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're a realtor, it definitely makes sense. And actually, you can pull properties up for your buyers from the MLS and make offers to those. But I think at the beginning, maybe not so much. And I know that you've been working at this for a while.
Yeah.
So I know this has got to be very frustrating for you.
Yes, it is. But I'm not giving up because now, I mean, I know it can happen now, but it just I guess the problem is on my part. I should have just been more proactive and just tell them, listen, since you have this, but then again, the same, and I know you just answered that too. I'm just wasn't paying attention to what you're saying about for sale by owners. They're listed. Those houses, when we market them, they're listed, and
they can
go online.
Yeah, some of them are, some of them are not.
Okay.
And if you go into forsalebyowner.com and fisbo.com and the local for sale by owner sites, you'll find a lot of them that aren't. And even on Craigslist, it'll tell you which one's a broker and which one's not.
Right. Okay.
So go after the ones that aren't brokers for now. Well, I mean, we go after everybody, but you can do that eventually.
Right.
But you already know now, you can get the buyer, you can get the seller,
right.
You can get the lease option memo signed,
mm-hmm.
and you know how to find a buyer.
Right.
And you've taken all the way through the process, except you didn't get the money.
and that was
because somebody ripped you off.
Right.
You know, is it your fault? Probably, ultimately, it is your fault. You got to take responsibility for it. But you could probably prevent it next time.
Right, I will. Don't worry, I will. The first house I bought, it was the older fella, and he used this term. He says, if a mule kick you one time, it's his fault. If he kick you twice, it's your fault.
Yeah.
And basically, that's it. So, you know, lesson learned on that.
Yeah. Well, you know, I got to express, you know, my admiration for you actually going out and doing this and hanging in there. I know that there's been dead spaces between the time you started it, and then you let it go, and then you start again. And
right.
You know, but I think that now you've learned over this period of time that, boy, it does work. You know, everybody can make this happen. It's just a matter of getting it closed and doing the right things and, you know, solving some of the issues that you're dealing with.
Oh, you know, I tell you, and I thank you for putting up with me, you know, in your program. It's been almost two years.
Jerome's in my mentor program, by the way, guys. yeah.
And I'm not taking no for an answer. This has to happen for me. I'm not giving up. There's no way I'm giving up.
That's why you're still with me.
Right. Thank you.
I'm serious.
No, you said that when I signed up. You said, listen, I don't want quitters. I don't want whiners. I don't want complainers. You were positive people.
Yeah.
And that's what it is.
And that's what I got from you. And that's why I hung in there with you.
It's going to happen, man. I'm telling you, it's going to happen. I'm going to make it happen. It's not going to be too much longer now.
Right.
All right. Hey, Joe, listen, I'm at work. I got to drive home in an hour. But listen, thank you for your time, I will keep you posted.
Yeah, let me know what happens.
And I'm sorry I got to cut out right now, but...
No problem.
All right, thanks, Joe.
Bye-bye now.
Take care, bye.
All righty, I'm going to open another call here. This one has an area code of 859. Who is it? Do you hear me?
Yeah, Joe, are you calling me?
Yes, you got an 859? Yeah, it must be you, because you're the one I can hear. What's your name?
Hey, Joe, this is Bill. This is Bill Raftor. I'm from Kentucky. How you doing today?
Hey, good, thanks.
Listen, first of all, I really enjoy your newsletters. They're awesome. You know, look forward to getting them every month, and they're just chock full of great information that I use in my business every day.
Excellent.
Question is you know, in your contacts all around the country, what methods are you finding that are the best, you know, for drawing in quick cash? I do work the for rent method. I mean, it's a great method, great system. I love that. And what additional techniques would you recommend?
I think that's one of the easiest ways to get cash happening fast of any that I've ever seen. Are you making money with it now?
Yeah, absolutely.
So how many deals are you doing, you know, every month or so?
Well, I do a whole array of deals, you know, in addition to that. That's just one component of my business.
Okay.
We do lease options. We do short sales.
Okay.
We do subject twos. We do a lot of different components in our business, you know, because, you know, I just believe you got to tap into all aspects of the business in order to maximize your deals, but we probably average about one or two a month.
So what systems of mine are you using? What programs of mine have you bought?
Well, I've got your...
Do you have push button?
Yeah, I have push button.
Okay.
I've got the program.
Okay. Let me just with push button. If you've got push button, you've got the majority of what I teach, as far as automation goes, which is where you need to be if you're only doing two a month. It sounds like you're doing pretty good with the other deals you've got going. If you're doing two of mine a month, plus that, you're probably well over the six-figure, a year type of thing anyway. But if you want to do more cash flow. These are cash flow types of deals. The Ferret method is cash flow deals. So if you want to do more of them, then it's a matter of automating that process and using those push button techniques. Are you using any of the web pages yet?
I have a website. My assistant, she uses the substitute method by hitting all of the websites.
Okay.
You know, the by owner websites.
Good, good. Are you using any of my websites?
No.
Okay.
No.
You got access to them there. You know how to set up a website?
She does. I don't.
Okay. We'll have her set it up. If you don't, I've got a guy that you can pay to do it. But,
okay.
But use the seller website and drive traffic to that. If you have her driving, the way that thing is set up, and we've got it for a few different things, but in the because I keep adding stuff to it, but in the push button method right now, there is a seller site for the for rent method, where you can send out an email blast or have somebody do it for you from Elance or maybe your assistant, pay them $7 or $8 an hour to do that. Then to go to each ad in Craigslist, for sale by owner, all the for rent method, all the for rent ads, and send them an email saying, hey, would you consider selling your home rent to buy rather than just renting it? If so, please let me know. And you have them respond to you by email. You then capture their email into an autoresponder, and that autoresponder then sells them on the idea of doing it. First of all, the autoresponder sends them to the website, and if you look, I'm going to give this to everybody on this call here. This is a freebie. If you look at buyersforyourhouse.com, that website is the seller website that I use. Now, this is licensed to the people that have my mentor program and the push button method. And when they fill out that form, that tells them all about what you do. And when they fill out that form, it's almost 100% conversion rate on those leads. Now, you're going to get fewer leads if you drive them to that traffic, to drive them to that site, but it's all automated for you. You've got so many other things going. You need to automate this stuff. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to do much more. The people that are just starting, when they haven't done a deal like this before, then they need to get on the phone and start calling down the ads by hand and asking those questions and using that script that I've given. But you are in the place where you're already doing this. You already know how to talk to people. You know how to put these deals together. You know how to find sellers for them. But you just need more of them. And you need to automate the process to bring in. So even if you brought in a couple extra deals a month, I mean, that would bump your income up by, $5,000 or $10,000 a month. Just by doing that one, implementing that one extra thing.
Absolutely. That sounds great.
And then there's so much more that you can do on top of that. There's the expired leads. There's the voice blast. There's all those other things that you can do that are also in that program. So it probably makes sense for you to go back and listen to that program again on some of the automated techniques that we've got.
Okay. Now, one question, Joe. Haven't they changed the laws through the FTC on this voice blast stuff? Are you aware of any of that?
What they allow you to do is... they don't allow you just to hang up if there's a person that answers. So it's got to be two messages. You can set it up so there's two messages, one that goes out if that person picks up and then another one that goes out if a voicemail picks up. And,
okay.
We kind of game the system a little bit. We have a voicemail that, because I like them to go to the voice, I'd like them to go to the voicemail rather than to the live person. We want them to think it's a live call. So if it goes to the voicemail, we have our regular voice message, which is, I saw your ad in the paper. Would you consider selling your home rent to buy rather than just renting it? If so, please give me a call. My name is Joe, phone number. And the one that goes, if they're live, is something along these lines. Operator 36257. and then it hangs up. And then you're in compliance without, you know, and maybe that's gaming the system a little bit, I don't know. but I think that that puts you in compliance. Now, one thing that you don't have to worry, people ask me all the time, do I have to worry about the do not call list? And you do not, because these people are advertising their phone number, and you're calling them specifically about that advertisement. You're not spamming them. You're calling them or emailing them specifically about what they're offering. You want to buy their property, and then you're going to assign it to somebody else.
Okay.
So yeah. That puts you within the compliance of the do not call list.
Okay, well, that's great. Well, yeah, I'll make it a point and within the next week to go back through the push-button method, because it's been a couple of years since I've been through that. So, but, you know, that's a great system for those that don't have it. You know, I know this is not a sales call and you're not selling, but just as a testimonial, it's a great system. And for those using the for-rent method, I'd highly recommend it or any of the other systems that you talk about.
Well, I always appreciate positive comments, so thank you.
Okay, you're welcome.
Thanks, Bill. Good luck to you.
You bet. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye. All right, I'm going to open up another one here. This is area code 520. Who have I got? 520. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Hey, who's this?
Wayne Weber.
William? Hey, how you doing?
Wayne, W-A-Y-N-E.
Oh, hey, Wayne. How's it going?
Yeah, Joe, I did.
That name is familiar. have we met?
I haven't met. Talked to you once, maybe, and okay. I got your push-button method and your cash flow newsletter.
Okay, great. Well, what can I do for you?
Well, okay, I've been in this actually 5 months now. I got 5 deals. I haven't done a closed one. I got one I want to ask you on. It was a high-end deal. It's a $500,000 one in the foothills and the mountains. I'm here in Tucson, Arizona. And I did a lease option on it. He has a $200,000 mortgage, and he don't have to sell it. And he has a few other houses, but and it's not doing. People, I showed it a few times, and it's a 30-year-old home, and a lot of people might say they want something newer if they're going to pay that for it. And it's actually in really good shape. It's been really taken care of well, and it's got mountain views. And I've approached them about lowering its price, and I had people make offers on it, the lower price, and he says no, he can't, don't need to lower it. So I was wondering if you had any suggestions on what kind of approach I could.
Well, first of all, congratulations for doing 5 deals in 5 months. How much, what do you average in per deal?
Well, I haven't closed them. I made five purchase agreements.
Okay.
Two of them are lease option, and three were cash.
And you just haven't found buyers for them? Are you doing the for-rent method, or are you doing where you'd buy them yourself?
I'm doing the for-rent method.
Okay. And you just haven't been able to find buyers for them?
I got 60 buyers on my list, and
but not for those properties specifically.
Right.
Because you haven't, so you haven't seen a payday on them.
That's right.
Okay.
I almost got one going here, and the guy won't return my calls on another lease option, and he's all excited about it, but the last he won't return my calls to do a purchase agreement on it.
Now, so you did you get him to sign the original lease option memo? Is this the seller you're talking about? Or the buyer?
Yeah, I did that with the seller, but the buyer, I can't. He won't return my calls.
Okay, so you've got to. I mean, let me clarify. I mean, maybe this is more important than your question, because if you've gotten through 5 deals and not gotten to the money, then that's an issue that you need to deal with. Because first of all, it sounds like on all 5 of those, you got the lease option agreement memo signed, right?
Right.
So and they all understood what you were doing. You put a sign in the yard. You put it on Craigslist, fillmyproperty.com, you put signs around the area.
Right.
On all those. And you had people calling on it.
Mm-hmm.
And why do you feel they didn't sell?
Well, I think the money, they couldn't get financed.
Why do they need financing?
Pardon? Three of them deals were cash.
Oh, okay. So there wasn't the for-rent method. Those were cash offers.
Just the three of them. I had two of them that were the for-rent.
Okay. Now, let's just take one of the cash offers, for example, because you can do cash offer, assignable cash offers, which it sounds like you were trying to do, right?
Right.
You've got an under-purchase agreement, and then you were going to assign your interest to someone else for a fee.
To a buyer, right.
Okay. You got to look at, when you're doing cash offers in this market environment, they better be very low. I mean, they better be very far below market value. We're talking 40, 50% below market value. Otherwise, you're not going to sell them.
Okay, I did that. The first one, he wanted $140,000 by owner.
Okay.
And two years ago, his agent had it for $240,000.
What's it worth right now?
The comps are right around $140,000.
Okay, so he was asking full market value for his property.
Right.
What happened 2 years ago really doesn't make any difference at all, other than the fact that maybe it'll come up again in the next 3 to 5 years.
Yeah, right. I offered him $115,000 and he took it.
Okay. So
I sold it five times and go ahead.
So $25,000 below market value, so it's about 16, 18% under market value.
Okay.
So you see why it didn't work?
Right. And then we lowered it to $80,000.
Okay.
And still, you know, I might think, you know, is it's the area. It's a very nice home. It's been remodeled and vacant since it's been remodeled for a year and a half, because they moved out and bought another home. And everybody likes that, sees it. And I showed it a half dozen times. But I think it's the area around it there, and it's not so well. The houses around it.
So he's willing to take $80,000. It's truly worth $140,000 right now?
Right.
And have you advertised it with the tax credit?
No, I haven't. I haven't done that.
Do you still have it under contract?
No, my 90 days are up.
Okay. Did you ask him for more time?
I did, but he's going to put it. He put it with a realtor, and
okay.
I just talked to him Sunday night, and he said it's under contract.
That's better. Yeah. If he had it for $80,000 with a realtor, it would sell, you know, overnight, because realtors have a better marketing tool for cash buyers. And if you put it under market value, you'll get the thing sold very quickly. If that value was really at $140,000 and he was selling it for $80,000 on the MLS, that thing would move very quickly. So what I would suggest is you stick with terms deals.
Right, that's what I'm going to do.
Yeah, now you could do, I bet you could still sell that one for $80,000 and pull $5,000 out of it pretty quickly. Or it might even make sense to buy it yourself, because that's a pretty good deal. Because especially if I was talking about the tax credit there on an $80,000 property, they can get $80,000 back on this tax credit at least till December 1st if you sell it before then, and so they're in it for $72,000. I mean, that's a half price property. That's a good deal for somebody, and it gets you might even be able to get your seller to accept terms on something like that if you can get him, you know, $5,000 up front. So
I approached them with terms twice, and they don't want it because they don't use that money to buy another place.
Why didn't he just refinance?
I've talked about that. His wife wouldn't go through with that.
So it wasn't about the money. It was about him not trusting you to make sure his payments are made.
Oh, I don't know.
See, I mean, if he knew that he could get the money, he just had to do it a different way that required that he have some trust for you, then that's where his stumbling block was. Not because he didn't want to, not because he couldn't get the money. Because the money was there, he just had to get it a different way.
Right. I told him to get a second mortgage,
and they
didn't want to do that.
Right. Okay. So, I mean, a lot of this has to do with learning how to talk to people and how to get this stuff, these ideas across. And, you know, that just takes practice. I mean, it sounds like you're doing the right things as far as going in the right direction with it. It's just a matter of, being proactive on these deals. And, first of all, I would suggest at the beginning maybe not doing cash deals and then focusing on terms deals and focusing specifically on the for rent method rather than even on subject to or land contracts or things like that, which are all doable, and especially in this market. This is the perfect storm for that. But it might be a little easier, as you get going. And you've already proven that you can get people to accept them. You've gotten a couple of lease option agreement memos signed already, right?
Right.
And why didn't they sell?
Well, the first one I mentioned there was $400,000. You know, people ain't got... they're looking at houses cheaper, you know.
How much was it?
$494, and he dropped it to $474.
Okay. How much did he owe on it? How much did he owe on it?
$200,000.
What do you think it was worth?
Comps are around $4,000.
Okay. So the value is there, and how much was he renting it for?
It's vacant right now, but he had it rented one time for $2,100.
So he was willing to take $2,100 for it? And so you were advertising it as a rent to buy for $2,100?
Right.
Is that what you were doing?
Right.
Okay. And when you advertised it, how did you advertise it?
Oh, I had a rent to buy lease option for 1 to 3 years.
Okay.
Was down payment. Part of the down payment to hold, just in case they walked.
Okay.
And I told him, no, that's fine, but I wanted part of that.
How much down payment did he want?
He wanted $25,000.
Okay.
But there's
your problem. So you know, on these deals, they don't get the down payment. They don't get the lease option fee. That's what you get paid. And $25,000 is not going to work anyway. He's not going to get that much. So you got to educate him and help him understand. So look, you don't have to pay me anything. I'm going to be paid by the buyer in this deal. What you're going to get is the first month's rent, and you're going to get full asking price without having to pay any fees. But I'm going to be getting the lease option fee. So when they understand that, and he says, no, I don't, what I want is $25,000. I said, well, I can understand you wanting $25,000. And I certainly think that would be nice. But it's not realistic for the way we're doing this. So there's a couple ways. Here's how I work. Here's the way I do it. And then explain how you do it, just what I said. And if he doesn't want to do it that way, then it's not really a real deal. If he's not working with you in the way that will make you money, then all you're doing is wasting your time.
All right.
So it's one thing to accept the deal and say, okay, let's get a sign in the yard and let's start driving some buyer traffic, get some buyer traffic so I can build my buyer's list. And that's good. But it doesn't make you money. It does bring you in buyers, and that gives you a little bit of confidence. But it's also going to frustrate you because you're trying to get $25,000 for a property that you're probably not going to get $5,000 for.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to make sure that you get that money, not him.
So what would you offer a lease option fee on that? What would you ask?
I would ask him how much he's got for the bent down payment. When the buyer tells me, well, I've got $2,000. Well, if you had $4,000, I know we could make this work. If he tells me $10,000, well, if you had $12,000, I know we could make this work. You don't advertise your down payment. You don't advertise your lease option fee. So get the monthly payment, which has got to be market rent. The price of the property isn't so, they're not so sensitive about the price.
Mm-hmm.
You can have them, we sold properties in California where all those properties are upside down, and their mortgages are higher than the values, but we can still get that higher price as long as our rent is at market rent. So if we can stay at market rent, then we're okay.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
So, yeah, right. Yeah. So I did get your email about your house you wanted to sell in Indiana, but I don't have the money. So it sounds like a really good deal.
Yeah, it's a pretty amazing deal. I've been picking up a lot of these little properties, and the return on the investment is pretty phenomenal. But it's only for people that have cash that they need to invest, like an IRA or there's two types of investing. One is passive investing, and one is active investing. That property, if you purchased it from me, would be a passive investment. Whereas for me, selling it is an active investment because I bought the property for less money than that. You know, I spent money to have it fixed up. I had a property manager, you know, fill the property with a Section 8 tenant, and we're getting 20, you know, and if I sell it to an investor, they're going to get 22%, 23% return on their cash investment without doing anything, zero. So I did the work. I'll make a chunk of money for selling that property, and then the passive investor will make money over the long term by holding that property. If they, let's say you had some money in an IRA or a Roth, you know, something like that, you could take that money and you could buy that property with it, and you get a much better return than you'll ever get in the stock market. and you won't have the risk of losing as much either, because you're buying it under value to start with. So those types
right.
of, you know, I don't have money in the stock market. None of my money's in the stock market. My money is in real estate, and it's even during this downturn, and we've lost some value in some of the properties that I own, but even in this downturn, that real estate has been solid, and it still makes income, and I bought the right kind of property. I didn't buy $400,000 and $500,000 condos in Florida hoping that they would go up 50% a year. You know, I bought good, stable, bread-and-butter properties that can sustain themselves over the long term with their rent. And, you know, that's for the ones that I was, you know, getting mortgages on or taking subject to, or, you know, where I was buying them on terms. The ones I was buying for cash, I'd buy these properties and get cash for them. I want to see a good return. Some of these little properties that we've got, we see that this is the most amazing return that I've seen in many years on properties like this. And to be able to turn around and sell them and be able to offer that kind of return and at the same time, you know, make a profit myself, I mean, that's not something we could have done even a year ago. So these are pretty good deals. Anyway, I won't. I know that you said you didn't have the money to do that, but I still think they're good deals for the right person.
Yeah, I thought also on that deal for $80,000. I also, if I had the money, I'd think, geez, that'd be perfect to buy and rent all.
Yeah, it's already rented. Oh, you mean the absolutely. If you had bought that one for, well, you also want to look at your return on investment, though. If you had $80,000, how much rent is it going to get? You could get.
You could get around $900,000 or
$900,000. So if you look at that, that's what, $8,400 minus your taxes. You're looking at maybe $7,000 in income on your $80,000 investment. So
mm-hmm.
if you do that, that's maybe a little less than 10%, 8% return on your money, right?
Right.
Whereas you take a property like these little ones that I've been doing, you know, and I did the same thing. I bought properties at $90,000 or whatever, and I'm getting $900 a month on them. Typically, what we've seen over the years is about a 1% return, you know, monthly. You know, between 8 and 12% has been pretty normal. But if you buy into some areas that maybe are a little bit more distressed, that are still good, solid blue-collar areas, that you can either get a lease option or either get a Section 8 tenant, a regular tenant, or a land contract buyer on those properties. You can see returns on these money that is you know, in the 20, 30, 40% rate, plus buying into a bunch of equity because there's so many properties available that have gone into foreclosure. So some really interesting deals out there right now.
Yeah, I listened to your monthly CD last night.
Oh, good.
Cash flow on, yeah, that was good.
Yeah. Yeah, that's got some of the new things that I'm doing, like in Detroit and Cleveland and some areas that I never thought I'd buy into. But
yeah.
But they're making me a lot of money. So pretty exciting stuff.
Yeah. See, in this rental one, would you stick to the lower end properties? Maybe would it be better, or does it matter?
On rent to own, it doesn't matter. No, I mean, the only thing that matters when you're dealing with more expensive properties is, you know, like, it doesn't matter whether it's a $10,000 property or a $1 million property, but the $1 million property, you're going to have more sophisticated sellers, and you're going to feel a higher level of intimidation dealing with that, especially if you're in a $200,000 house. You know, so if you're, because you'll feel intimidated by that seller, perhaps. But there's no reason to, because the numbers are the same, and there's just as many people out there with bad credit that have $6,000 a month that they could pay for rent than have, you know, $900 a month. There are people out there that are in that situation that have bad credit that can't get a loan but need a house, and they'd be happy to pay the $5,000 or $6,000 a month that takes to get $1 million or $1.5 million property.
Mm-hmm.
So don't shy away from those. It's a great learning ground anyway. As soon as you learn to talk to people, you'll be in better shape.
Mm-hmm. So on the high-end ones, just still basically ask them how much they got for a down payment rather than trying to set a fee?
Correct. So when they call you, that's the first question you're going to ask them. Make sure that they've got some money. Otherwise, don't waste much time on them.
Mm-hmm. All right.
And even if they had $1,000, you know, or $2,000 first and last month, take the money. You know, take the money and close the deal. You know, as you get better, you'll start looking for ways to find them more money. There's other places that people have, other resources they have that they don't think about, and you can help them think about those things. But at the beginning, just focus on getting the money, getting one of these closed. And I would focus, you know, put all your energy into the for rent method, because that thing is the cash flow. It's the easiest to get to the money, and it's also a wonderful training ground to learn how to talk to these sellers, especially if you go back and listen to the push button stuff on how to talk to sellers and how to put those deals together.
Mm-hmm. All right.
All right. Good luck, Wayne.
All right. Thanks a lot, Joe.
Good talking to you.
Yeah. Same.
All right, I'm going to put Wayne on mute, and I'm going to go to the next question. And by the way, if you came on the call since we started, the way that you raise your hand to ask a question in this is by pressing 5-star. And I'll just take these calls in the order that they come in. This next one I've got is a phone number that starts with the area code 765. Who am I talking to? Are you still on the line? 765 is the phone number, or is the area code. Just speak up. If you put yourself on mute by chance, you have to press 4-star to bring... Oh, no, you're not on mute. I can see here. I'm still learning how to use this new thing. Let me refresh my browser here and see if it makes a difference. One last chance. Area code 765, speak up. Okay, I'm going to put you back on mute. Maybe you've changed your mind or your question is already answered. Okay, the next one I've got here is area code 501. Who's that?
Hello?
Yes.
Joe?
Yes.
Joe, good afternoon. This is Carol Leonard in Little Rock, Arkansas.
Hey, Carol, how you doing?
I'm good. I appreciate you keeping track of me on the answering my emails over time. Couple of questions. It says in the lease option memo, you know, if you find somebody first, then the deal's off, no hard feelings. Do you just basically tell them you can keep your ad in the paper, but I want my sign in the yard?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
What you're going to find most of the time is that people are going to they're going to abdicate their everything to you. Once they've signed you on and allowed you to do this, they're not going to want to screw with it anymore, and they're going to trust you to do it.
Well, I wish they would, because here's my second question. I've kept track of phone number. Hello?
I'm still here. I can hear you.
Okay. I've kept track of people. I used to do some flipping and stuff like that, and I kept track of... So I'm calling people back that I've talked to 2 or 3 years ago. Anybody out of town or out of state, I am like money from home. You know, where have you been? When can you start? You know, stuff like that.
Right.
I hadn't gotten paid on anything yet, but the people in town, like, have properties, have one property, they have 20 properties, whatever, they look at me like it's no big deal. And they, one fellow said, what are you bringing to the table? I said, I'm here to work for free to save you time. You've got enough things to do, because I've been in your situation. You've got enough things to do owning property. Let me do this for free.
Do they like that explanation?
It doesn't seem to faze them. And I say, look, you know, I used to be a house painter. If I said, you know, I'll paint your rent house, well, how much do I owe you? Nothing. I'll just get it from the renters. Who wouldn't jump on that? You know,
right.
I don't know what it's. I'm not as needy as I used to be when I talked to them.
Yeah, makes a big difference.
Yeah, but it just seems like I don't know the there's something. I've been listening to your CD about, you know, talking to people and being authoritative but not pushy and knowing what you're talking about.
Right.
But it's like, it's not clicking. It's clicked for me. You know, I did this before by accident, just by listening to you once or twice a couple of years ago. But I haven't been able to close one since. The ones that I did get signed, the lease option memo, they wanted so much, and it was just ridiculous. And I said, you know, if I get $500 out of these people, I'll be doing well, because, you know, the area... You had to fight your way into it and shoot your way out. But I guess you just, you know, if it's costing me nothing, let's just see if he can get the moon.
Right.
So I got people to sign on, but I knew, it's like you was talking to the earlier fella, I knew going in that it was probably they were just yanking my chain. And so I put the signs out, and I built up a list and all that. But it wasn't a feasible deal. But people out of town, out of state that I've stayed in touch with over time, this is the grandest thing.
For buyers or sellers?
Sellers.
Mm-hmm. So,
but for whatever reason, they haven't signed on as of yet.
Okay.
Well,
what
now?
Here's the place you have to go with these people, with these sellers. You have to find their pain. You have to find what they need. Because they don't care about you. They don't care that you're free. What they care about is what they need and what their pain is. And sometimes they have to be reminded of their pain. And you know, if you look at the script, the lease option agreement script, the for rent script, it's all about finding their pain by asking them questions. So what is it you're trying to accomplish? You know, are you got payment on this property? If they got a payment on the property and they got a vacant property, that's painful. I mean, it's painful for me. When I have a property that's vacant that I'm making a payment on, it's painful. I hate to see that money going out every month. And they're the same way. They don't want to see that. Plus, they're getting calls, and they don't like that. But they might be willing to deal with that. But if you've got something that they don't have, how big is your buyer list right now?
Well, it's scattered over probably 100 miles, but there's probably 200 or 300 people on it.
Okay.
Probably 200.
I would find out exactly. So, look, I got 237 people on my buyer's list right now that are interested in this area. And you can be vague about what that area is.
Right.
And I have a proprietary source of online internet buyers that I tap into. So the likelihood is, and I don't mean to be arrogant, but the likelihood is that I'm going to fill this property a whole lot faster than you are. So if you want me to do it, this is how I work. These are the things that I need in order to make that work. And then you tell them how you work, and you tell them what you need. Things like the sign in the yard, you know, the lockbox in the front door. You need to be able to, you know, advertise this thing and not have their sign in the yard. You know, all those things that make it possible for you to make money. It has to be priced properly. Otherwise, you're wasting your time. You know, if you look at, and I learned this from being a realtor way back when, you can list properties all day long, but if you don't price them properly, they won't sell. So you got to make sure they're priced properly. Otherwise, you're just wasting your time. And there is some value in putting a sign in the yard and building your buyer list, but you got 200 people on the list already. You don't need more buyers. You know, not to say that any of those will buy the properties that you get tomorrow, because most of those buyers are going to come from the sign in the yard, a specific advertisement for that property. But being able to say you got 237 buyers to a seller gives you a lot of credibility, because you got something that they don't have.
Right.
And if they want to work with you, if they want access to your list, you know, and when they say, you know, I really don't want to do it your way, I understand. You're not interested in the 237. You don't want me to tell my 237 buyers about your property,
right?
Because I think I've got somebody that might be interested. But if you're not interested in doing it, I understand. You know, I've got all these buyers, and I'm in a little bit of a pinch because I don't have as many sellers. So I'm looking for somebody that wants to work with me, who wants to solve their problem. I'll make a little bit of money. The buyer gets what they need. You know, it's a win-win-win situation for everybody. And when you start talking to people like that, you're going to start getting more compliance with what you need, because you're solving their problem. If you go to a doctor and you got a heart problem, and you tell a doctor, you know, I think I got a heart problem, and he does some tests on you, and he doesn't ask you any questions about it. He just says, well, maybe you should take these pills. You're not going to trust him too much. And then he's going to say, well, they're free.
It's worth what you're willing to pay for it.
So instead, what he does is tells you, he asks you a bunch of questions, finds out what your pain is, he does some diagnostic to find out the best way he can solve the problem, and then he says, you know, Carol, I'm going to have to cut your chest open, and I'm going to have to do open heart surgery, and it's going to cost you, you know, tens of thousands of dollars that you're going to pay for my expertise. But I'm going to save your life. Would you pay that guy?
Bill.
Am I talking to Bill?
Yeah, when do we start?
So that's...
Well, excuse my interruption, but it's, you know, I think I'm going to start telling them, look, I've got these 200 buyers that are interested. You can either, you know, and I tell them, I said, what I want to do is, like, if I call them and it's supper time, I say, I want to be the one that gets this call at supper time. You've got enough things to do, and I'm just going to start. Let me ask you this. If I start telling them, you know, I've got 200 buyers now, or you can weed through them one at a time on the phone, but I can speed this up for you. Would that make sense?
Sure. But do you know what their pain is?
Got to find the pain first.
Yeah. What do they need? They don't care about you.
It's like you said on the CD. Until you know that, like the guy was talking about, one guy that was arrogant. He was probably retired military, and he said maybe he enjoys that. And people would rather be right than be happy. So some of them just they don't want to. I don't know. They're just hard-headed.
You can't help everybody. And,
sure.
And by the way, sometimes hard-headed people just need it. They need to talk to hard-headed people. So, you know, if somebody's being hard-headed with you, if you're just hard-headed back with them, try it sometimes. Like, I'm a pretty mild-mannered guy, you know. And when somebody gets really aggressive with me, I used to, you know, kind of back down. But I learned that if I got aggressive back with them, you know, just spoke louder and more, you know, here's the way it's got to be, and you got to do this and do that, and you're being crazy about this, and don't be nuts. You know, I only do that with people that are really aggressive. By the way. but if they're really aggressive, they will, a lot of times they'll back down, and they'll actually, it's like the, you know, it's that mentality of, you know, you got to get into a fight with somebody and then you're best friends for life. I don't quite get that mentality, but.
Yeah, I've never understood that.
but I, you know, I guess when you're drunk, that's
all the rules are off. Okay, well that's what I've been doing is I've been telling, you know, I've been trying to explain to them, this is how easy this is. You know, I can start today, but I haven't bothered to find out their situation yet.
Yeah, and they won't work with you until they trust you. So okay. And if they don't think that you're thinking about them, they don't trust you. A lot of people go in, especially when they're starting out, they go in at, they're really thinking about, how am I going to make $5,000? I gotta make $5,000. I gotta make my rent next month. I want to get this deal going. I want to make my business start to work, and that's all well and good. You know, we all want to make money at this, but until you change your focus and start thinking about them, how can I solve their problem? You know, what is it they're trying to accomplish? If you were talking to your let's say your son. I don't know if you got kids, but let's say you got a son and he's having a problem, you know, selling his house. You're going to give him advice on how to do that. How would you talk to him? You wouldn't say, "Hey, I can do this for you. You know, won't cost you anything." You're not going to talk to your son like that. You're going to say, "You know, son, here's what you need to do. Here's how you need to solve this problem. You know, you tell me what's wrong here. Tell me what's wrong there. Okay, so if I'm understanding right." This is the problem here. You got to make this payment every month. You got a vacant property. You're looking for buyers. You're spending money every month on classified ads and these other ads to try to get that to happen. You know, is there any other, you know, I mean, what happens if you don't find a buyer, first of all? Do you lose the property? Does it go into foreclosure? Or do you just make payments out of every month? And where does that money come from? Does it come out of your retirement account? Does it come out of your income every month, your disposable income? You know, is that a problem you'd like to have solved? If that is, here's how I can solve that problem for you. Here's how we can make that work for you. And here's what you have to do in order to make that happen. And say, and you know, there's no free lunches here. What I'm going to do, you know, I'm not charging anything for this. I'm going to be paid by the buyer. But I am going to ask that you do it, that we do it a certain way, because I know, because of my experience, I know what works the best, and I know what doesn't work. And there's no reason for us to waste your time or mine or a buyer's time if we can't make this deal work. So here's how we've got to lay it out. I've got to have my sign in the yard. I've got to have my lockbox in the front door. I've got to be able to advertise for this. And I need a little bit of cooperation from you as we go through this. I also ask that you not go around me when I bring a buyer. You know, so that when I bring a buyer, you know, and by the way, the contract I'm having you sign here, it's a stab me in the back kind of contract. It allows you to stab me in the back, and I'm trusting you not to do that. So these are the things that I'm asking you. Is that okay? We'll get the problem solved. You know, shall we get going? And that's a whole different way of talking to somebody than I'm going to do this for you for free. I'm going to, you know, this is why it makes so much sense to you. You see the distinction?
Yeah. Okay. I can see that.
Give it a try and see how it works for you, because okay. I think it'll make a difference for you. And every time you get off the phone, think, do you have kids?
Yes, I do. I got one. Got a boy.
Okay. So when you talk to your kids, what age are they by then?
He turned 5 last week.
Okay, so you got a little one. You know, if he walks over and puts his hand up by the stove, you know, do you say, you know, it wouldn't be a really good idea for you to do that? No, you go, don't touch that.
Yeah.
Get your hand back from there, you know.
Yeah.
And you worry about the politeness later. You make sure he understands what he needs to do. You talk to, and when I say you talk to these people like children, I don't mean you do it with disrespect. I mean you do it with love. And you do it with consideration for what they're trying to accomplish and knowing that you know better than they do. Because believe me, if you've listened to my stuff, you know better how to make this thing work than they do. It doesn't take much for you to know more than them. And even experienced investors, you know, that have been doing it for 20 years. I've got, you know, people that have been in my mentor program for weeks, and they'll talk to these experienced investors, and the investors will say, man, I got to have lunch with you. I got to pick your brain. I hear this all the time from my mentor students, because they suddenly, as soon as they get the words in their mouth that I teach them, you know, then they suddenly become respected, and they become trusted, because they sound like they know what they're talking about, even though they may not. You know, they may get off the phone and immediately call me up and say, Joe, what do I do now? I say, well, here's what you do next. And that's how we take them to the next process.
Okay. Well, I started from the wrong direction.
You're heading in the right direction, though. I mean, because you make mistakes, you learn from that process. You know, I said this to a guy earlier, to Jerome earlier. I really admire the people that do the work. You know, when people come into my mentor program, I tell them there's a certain percentage of people that are not going to do the work, and they're not going to make a dime, because this is not a get-rich-quick scheme. This is a business-building program. If you treat it like a business, you'll make money. But there's a learning curve to it. You got to give yourself time to learn this process. I tell everybody that starts my program, give yourself 3 or 4 months before you can expect to make any money at all. And I got people that do it in a week, that make money in a week, but they're the exception, not the rule. So give yourself the time to learn, because once you start doing it and you start making this kind of money, you'll look at every time somebody does a deal, maybe it took them 3 months to get a deal done. And when they, you know, if somebody's in my mentor program, and I'll say, well, okay, so how much time did you have in this deal? Well, probably 5 hours. Okay, so 5 hours, how much did you make? $5,000. So you made $1,000 an hour, right? You know, you've been working at it 3 months, but you still, the actual time you put into that deal was only a 5 hours. So if you started becoming more consistent and your abilities worked on a higher level, you'd be making much, much more per hour every time you do this, and you won't be spinning your wheels on a bunch of stuff that's not working, and you'll be focused in on the things that do work. And that just comes with some practice. There's a learning curve to this, and once you get that, then starts getting more exciting.
Right. Well, that's what I'll do. Well, I did the first one. I did it wrong, but it was just I just fell out of a tree on me, and that was a couple of years ago, and I bailed out of this, and then I'm trying to get back in it. So, I'll try that. I'll talk to them different.
Well, you know it works. You've been through the process. You've made money.
Yeah.
You know, now it's just a matter of getting, learning the subtleties enough so that you can make it work consistently. And once you do that, then it's a matter of automating everything so that you can do it on a regular basis.
Right. I want to quit a job.
Well, that, okay. I think that's the goal of a lot of people. You know, it's not about getting rich. It's about the lifestyle. And you really can have truly an excellent lifestyle just on 6 figures a year. You know, and you can make a lot more than that just doing the for rent method. And then if you start adding some of these other things, like, you know, Bill from Kentucky was doing, where you start adding some of the other techniques that I'm teaching, then things get even more exciting. And then you can start building wealth and you start holding on to the properties and, you know, then you leave a legacy for your children. And that's
millionaire matrix thing, that I think about that like once a week. Like, it could be so much different in a couple of years from now, you know.
Exactly.
But I really appreciate your time.
Well, hang in there with it, you know, and I'll be anxious to hear how it works out for you.
Okay, I'll keep you posted. All right. Thanks.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.
All right, let me open up another one here. This one is 804 area code. Who have I got?
804, that must be me, Dave McGee.
Hey, Dave, how you doing?
I'm doing great, and I hope you're doing well. And I want to say I appreciate all the free things that you give us to help us make us successful. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for saying so.
Couple of questions. I'm on the for rent, and I just recently got the push button method about 2 months ago, and I finally got some of the websites set up for the push button method. When I do a voice blast, what script do I use for the sellers? You have one where it goes into quite lengthy, you know. It says, you know, I have 172 buyers, I have this problem.
Do the short one. Now, that seems to be the one that's converting the best for us. And so
what is it?
It's the one that says, I saw your ad, whether it's Craigslist or whatever source you're pulling from, saw your ad in Craigslist about the home you've got for rent, and I was wondering if you consider selling that home rent to buy. If you would, please give me a call. Here's my number, my name, and leave it at that.
Do you also throw them to the website, your website again?
You can, but I think that what I would first do is try to get them to respond to you. I think you're going to get the most people are going to call you back. If you're doing an email blast, let's say you're going and doing all the for sale by owners, and you're doing all the for rent ads in Craigslist or from my property or, you know, Fizbo.com or one of those places, then you'd want them to send you back an email, and then you can start dripping on them with an autoresponder by saying, go to this site, tell us what I'm doing. But if you're trying to get this thing and you really kick it into gear instead of just automating, because there's two different processes here. One is, first of all, learning how to do it and talk to these sellers, and that's where I suggest you just get on the phone and do it. Then there's the automation. Once you know how to do it, once you know how to put a deal together, then you start the automation. And you get the automation going, and the idea there is to drive traffic to you on a regular basis. But at the beginning, you're still trying to create cash flow right up front so that you can quit your job and do this full time. So what I would suggest, rather than creating the constant stream, what I would do is get them to call you back and respond immediately to them. Because, again, those we're looking at the qualification of the leads that you're getting. The lowest qualification leads is people you call right off the ad and just call straight out. The next level of qualification is where you send out an email or a voice blast to them saying I'm interested and having them call a voicemail or call you back directly. That's the second level. The third level is where you now have money coming in, you got a regular business going, and you want to keep it going, and you want to even maybe expand your area. So you hire somebody to do those blasts for you, email and voicemail blasts for you, and they send out an email, and they get a response email, because then you collect their email, puts them into an autoresponder that I've already written, and then it sends them out to your website that explains how the for rent method works for a seller. And you try to get them to opt in. That way, when those people opt into the web page, those are highly qualified leads. And those, we have almost 100% conversion rate on those. So do you see how we're taking it from step by step, going from a less qualified lead, but you got to get your business running, to a more qualified lead, but you still have to get your business running, to your business is already running, but you need to expand it to the most qualified lead. And then you can expand it out, and you can start hitting and just getting really qualified leads coming in. Because you're going to get fewer. Every time you do more qualification, you're getting fewer leads. I guess I didn't mention that. So you want to be able to, at the beginning, you want to be able to maximize the amount of people you're talking to. At the end, you want to reduce that to almost none. But you can't really reduce it to none and expect to have a closing ratio unless you know how to talk to these people.
Right.
And the way you talk, the way you learn to talk to them is by, you know, obviously listening to what I teach, but also actually getting on the phone and doing it. You can, it's like playing the piano. You can learn music theory all day long, but if you sit down and start hitting those keys, you're not going to learn how to play piano.
Well, I got a couple of, I've got about four or five sellers that were interested, but I didn't know how to talk to them and convert them, so that was my issue. So that's why I thought I'd start going with sending out the voice blast.
That's not going to convert. Well, it might convert some, but it'll convert not enough to make you a living. So you want to be able to learn how to convert so that everyone that comes in, when you use the more qualified lead source, will be able to convert. Otherwise, the leads will be too far and few and far between, and it'll take you a lot longer.
You mean if you do the voice blast?
If you do the voice blast, before you do the voice blast, I would suggest you just get on the phone and start dialing down the numbers of the people that are on Craigslist.
Uh-huh.
Just calling them and ask them the question. You know, would you consider selling rent to buy?
Right.
You know, so that's the first step where you learn how to talk to those people and get them done. The next step is the automation.
One of the advantages that we've been talking about is that you have said we've got our buyers working with a mortgage guy, and they are helping them qualify for their mortgage in 1-2 years or whatever it is.
Right.
And
back off.
Today's market
we've changed things a little bit from that. So because of the way the market's going right now. Right now it's harder to qualify for a loan than it's ever been in my entire experience as an investor. So instead, what I'll say to sellers is it's unlikely that the person is going to exercise the option. There's a 30% chance or less that they'll actually exercise the option. But while they're there, you're going to have somebody who sees the property as their own, treats it as their own, and is going to be more likely to take care of that property. So, and if they do buy it, they're going to pay you full price for it. So it's a good deal all the way around. If they don't buy it, then you can find somebody else to move them in. But at least during that time, you've had somebody covering your mortgage, and you've been making money, you've been getting your depreciation, you've been getting your appreciation, you've been getting a buy down of the note, and you've been able to have a sustainable property. So these are the things that I can do for you by putting a lease option tenant in there that make more sense than either if you're renting it, then just putting a regular tenant in there, or if you're selling it, then having to drop your price so dramatically and pay a realtor fee and end up coming to closing with tens of thousands of dollars.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and then where would I go to find the FSBOs? You've listed a couple of sites before, but where would I go to find them?
First place I go is Craigslist. FSBO.com, FSBO.com, ForSaleByOwner.com.
What is that again?
FSBO.com. It's spelled FSBO.com.
Okay.
And then ForSaleByOwner.com. And then if you just type in ForSaleByOwner into Google, you'll get local results as well. Because every area has its own for sale by owners. But most people are showing up in Craigslist these days.
What is your conversion rate on these FSBOs and for sale by owners?
You mean as far as if we do a blast to them?
A rent to own.
Rent to own, like an email blast to them?
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing 8 or 10% respond saying that they wouldn't be interested in listening to what we have to say. Then it's up to the person who's doing the conversion to get it done. And that's anywhere from 90% to the guys that are good to zero to the guys that aren't any good.
But what I see
a lot of is the guys that are no good, if they keep doing it, they get to that 90% eventually.
Did I hear you say that on one of your messages that on the voicemail blast that the conversion rate was only like 2% or 3%?
I'm not sure if what you're referring to. I mean, if you're talking about the voice blast, because I've done different studies on what kind of conversion you get based on what you ask and what you say.
Right.
Whether you give a phone number, whether you give a website, whether you give both. And I've done different studies on that. I think And what I found is that it tends to confuse everybody when I give them conversion rates and what they can expect. In general, let me just give you an overall concept here. If you get on the phone and you call people, 1 in 3, and you say, would you consider selling your home rent to buy rather than just renting it, when you're talking to people who are advertising their home for rent, 1 in 3 will say, yeah, I'd consider that. 1 in 3. Out of that 1 in 3, then it's a matter of how good you are to be able to close the deal and whether they feel that you're competent and whether they feel you know what you're doing. At the beginning, you're probably not. But even then, sometimes you just stumble into things and out of blind, dumb luck, they say yes and you get the deal and you put it together and you go to the next step. And that happens actually pretty frequently. But with people that have never done it before. And that's how a lot of people get their first deal. But then sometimes I'll have guys, and I had a guy on my call earlier today who's been working at it for a while, and things are just going wrong, left and right. He's getting so far, he's getting good on the phone. I know he's good, but it's not coming together for him. And so he's really struggling making that happen. And so, again, it comes back to them trusting you, believing that you can do it, and then being in control of the transaction through that process and learning how to do that. And once he cracks the code, once he is able to do it the first time, his confidence will build, I think, to the point where he'll be able to do it over and over and over again. And he's been strong enough to hang in there as these things have gone wrong. And he's learned a lot of things. On the other hand, I've got people that aren't very good at all, that put deals together, and then they get their first deal done, and then it takes months to learn the process again because they didn't get lucky the second time. Then it takes months to get the second deal done.
And they get first, so what's your conversion rate on voice blast, just a straight voice blast then?
Typically 8 or 10% will return your call.
Okay.
On a straight voice blast to a qualified lead source.
Okay.
So you've got to look at the type of voice blast you're doing, who you're doing it to, all that stuff. That's what the push button method is all about, teaching you all those different things. So it might be worth going back. You got that program, right?
Yes, I do.
So you can go back and listen to that, and it'll give you some of the details. But I think that if you talk to 100 sellers, if you just go down the list and talk to 100 different people who have their homes advertised for rent, if you don't put a deal together talking to that first 100, I will be very surprised. And if you don't, there's probably a reason. If you don't, usually I see, after talking to 20 or 30 people, and actually talking to them, not just dialing and leaving a message, but actually talking to them, and going through the process and not hanging up when they say no. On my, I got a new lease option for rent script, and on it says, you can't hang up till you get 5 no's. And I show them how to do that and why that makes sense and what questions to ask and all those things, so you're not completely obnoxious doing it. But when you learn how to take, when they say no, what they're saying is, I don't trust you, or I don't understand you, or you're not solving my problem. And if that's happening, they're making a mistake. So, ethically, you have a responsibility to them to be able to solve their problem. You're on the phone there. You're able to help them solve their problem. Why should you let them hang up at that point? You need to find out why they're saying no. So that's the next question, why? And then you ask them questions about their situation, find out what their pain is.
So when you see ads that advertise lease to purchase, and they're pretty good leads, I would think, right?
And they can be, but again, you have to know how to talk to them.
I could see where that's good and bad, because if you're trying to get a fee,
they may be thinking they're going to get it as well.
Yeah.
So then you have to sell them on that idea. But a lot of them are just interested in getting their monthly payment covered. As a landlord, owning properties, I want my monthly payment covered. I don't want to have to make that payment. If I don't get my, if I have to pay, I pay property managers to fill my property all the time. So if I don't get the money up front, it's not that big of a deal. I'd like to have it, be great, but if I don't get it, I can live with that. Just as long as I get somebody in there, keeping me from having to come out of pocket.
Was it anything different, a different approach if you talk to them? Because, like I said, I think they'd be looking at they want to get the down payment themselves.
Sure. But they, what's more important to them, filling the property quicker or getting the down payment?
Mm-hmm.
So if they, let's say, and you'll get the same question from people who want a deposit, because I don't give deposits. Well, some of my students do because they haven't quite got comfortable not giving it to them. But you don't want to give a deposit because it cuts into your income dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to help them understand that you can fill it quicker than they can, and that it'll end up being cheaper in the long run for you to fill it, and then it will be for them to go through the pain to fill it and the time, extra time that it takes for them to fill it. If it takes you 2 weeks to fill it and it takes them 6 weeks to fill it, they lost that money anyway. So does it make more sense for them to spend that money on rent or on a mortgage payment? Or does it make more sense to get somebody in there, get it settled, and not have to worry about it anymore?
I only have 48 qualified, well, I should say, as best I can, qualify buyers. Does that sound credible?
Yeah.
Can you say 48?
You can say 12. You can say, you know, some of my students have said, you know, they don't really believe me when I tell them I have 732 buyers. I said, well, tell them you got 12.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah. All right, John. Well, so, that answers a lot of my questions. Thank you.
All right. Good luck, Dave.
Okay. Appreciate it, John.
You bet. Bye-bye. All right. Let me open the next one here. This is this is a 765.
Hello?
Yes. Who's this?
Hi, Joe. This is Mark Fisher.
Hey, Mark. How you doing?
All right. Listen, I've got a question. I set up some websites, and I'm getting a lot of leads for people out of state. And I don't know, do you have a course set up so you know how to handle to get somebody to put, or to, for the steps, I guess, to get somebody to put signs up? I know you talked about Edlance, but I've not had any luck with that in the area that I was after.
Yeah, you won't find sign placers in Elance. No, that's for administrative people. What I would use is Craigslist.
And
it also depends on what resources you already have. Do you have any resources in that area already? Anybody?
No, I'm trying to build resources in the area, actually.
Okay. So put an ad in Craigslist and ask them, do you have the push button method?
No, I just got your fast track coaching and the zero down.
Okay. Put an ad into Craigslist and ask them, you know, tell them you're looking for a sign, somebody to place signs for you, and explain exactly what you want. And I think it'll, you'll find, you'll get quite a few calls. You know, pay a dollar to a dollar and a half for them to place a sign for you. The trick is you got to get them the sign, or you've got to get them to go out and buy the signs and create them for you, because you want the handwritten signs if you can get them. And you can find people to do that too. You just got to pay them a little bit extra to cover the materials. And I think what I would do instead of putting a bunch of signs up in a particular area, because you might want to go down there and do it yourself one day and just put a bunch of signs out. But maybe as a starter here, just send a sign to the seller that they can put in the front yard. Rent to buy, no qualifying, move in today, phone number. And with that, they can put that in the front yard. They'll put the lockbox that you mailed them on the front of the house, and you start taking calls. Get the property into fillmyproperty.com, get it into Craigslist, get into any other free, house for sale type website that you can find. I wouldn't spend much money on ads until you went through 30 days to find out whether or not you can sell it with those basic things.
Okay.
And I think I think that'll solve your problem. And then when we need to show the property, we do it with a lockbox. If it's a vacant house, if it's not a vacant house, then you got to get somebody to help you. And we've had realtors help us where we'd say, look, we'll give you $500 if you'll show the property. Plus, you can also have access to the buyers if they buy something, you know, through the MLS. You know, you can make a commission on them, or you can, you just pay us a lead fee for those. They can't pay you a referral fee, but they can pay you a lead fee for it. Let them figure out how to do that so that they can feel like they're complying with the board. And you know, just pay them $500 to fill the property and to do the paperwork for you. So if you're going to get $2,000 for, and I would be the one that takes the buyer calls, and then when there's time for the to talk to the to show the property, and you need to have somebody show it, then have that realtor do it. Or the way we do it with a lot of properties is we just put that lockbox in the front of the door and say, go to the house, call me from the front porch, and I'll give you the lockbox code. And wait till they get to the front porch. They call you on their cell phone. You give them the lockbox access. They go in the house. They check it out. You tell them, you know, either stay on the phone while they're walking through the house with them, or say, call me back as soon as you leave. I want to make sure it got locked up. And when they call you back, you tell them, you know, what'd you think of the property? You try to sell them on the idea of getting it down, getting it done. Does that make sense?
Okay. Yeah, it does. Now, my other question is, you mentioned having a realtor or somebody in a outlying area to do some work for you. If do you have any certain method or system that you qualify a realtor or somebody to work with you? I mean, is there certain things that you specifically ask for?
I ask them if they want to do it.
Okay.
Yeah, and I ask them, you know, I say, you know, you want to find out a little bit about them. You want to find out if they're 100% broker. I guess that's one of the things that we do check. Because if they're not 100% broker, then they got to do a split with their broker, and giving them $500 is not going to make them very happy. But if it's a REMAX agent, or if it's a 100% agent, you know, the one who doesn't have to do a split with their broker, then they can take $500 and they get the whole amount. Agents get paid two ways. I don't know if you know this or not, but agents get paid two ways. One is they work for a broker, and that broker gives them a percentage, usually half, 50% of the commission. Broker keeps 50%. But they cover their desk fees and, you know, office fees and, you know, office support and all that stuff. But you only get 50% of your commission. Then you got the companies like REMAX that are called 100% brokers. And they pay a monthly fee. The agent pays a monthly fee to rent their space. And then they get 100% of their commission when they make it. Anybody who's doing a lot of production is going to be a 100% broker. You'd be either that, or they're going to really negotiate a great deal with their agent, with their broker, to give them a very small percentage. Because you start, it makes sense. I know that 6 months after I became an agent, back when I started being an agent, I switched over to be a 100% broker, because I would have made more money even during that first 6 months as a 100% broker than I did as a given 50% of my money away.
Okay. Then I have another question. Before I found you, I took a home subject to using a different system. And I did not record the warranty deed. This has been like 2 or 3 years ago now. And I have the paperwork, but I decided I wasn't able to get. Well, in fact, I'm going through the process right now of evicting the first lease option buyer. And so my question is, am I under the assumption right that a warranty deed will expire, so there's no way I could file that one now? I would have to look up the original owner and sign another one so I could put something like that on file?
Well, talk to your county recorder. The deed does not expire. I mean, it was transferred when they handed it to you.
Okay.
They signed it. They did. It was prepared properly. It was signed in front of a notary, right?
Yes.
So that when they handed it to you, that's the actual transfer of the deed. Now, it's not recorded, so it's possible that somebody could come in and record something under you, or, you know, whatever. But I don't record every deed that I get either. The reason I don't record every deed is because of taxes, right? Usually there's homestead exemptions on a property that keep the property taxes a little bit lower. But when those homestead, if I record the deed and show that a corporation owns it, those homestead exemptions go away and the taxes can double. So it can knock your payment up by a few $100.
Okay.
So that you know, gets rid of your cash flow if you've got any. So, you know, I don't always record it either, and I just hold them. But I'm still the owner. I'm still, you know, the legal owner. I have been told in the past, and I've never seen this, but I have been told in the past that there are some areas that if it's not a recent recent deed, then they may not record it. So you might want to call the county recorder and find out if they'll accept a deed that was done, you know, years ago, and see what they say. My guess is they will, because it is illegal. It was a legal transfer at the time. They don't have to be recorded to be transferred.
Okay. All right.
So does that answer the questions?
That does. I just wanted to let you know I appreciate your time. I was able to take another house subject to just 2 days ago.
Fantastic.
And so we're kind of working with a gun here, trying to do something in 90 days if I can because of foreclosure, where it's heading. But anyway, I really appreciate your time and answered my emails. That's been great.
You bet. Well, good luck to you, and I wish you all the best.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. Bye-bye. All right, is this Bill?
No, Joe?
Yes.
This is Carol again. I got connected back to you. Okay. I didn't have another question. Sorry.
You do not? Okay.
No.
Okay.
Thanks.
All righty, I'm going to put you back on mute there. All right, according to my... Let me refresh the page here and see if any new hands have been raised. And again, to raise your hand to ask a question, you press 5-star. And I should be able to see it on my web screen here, all things being equal. I'm going to wait here for the page to refresh, because for some reason it's taken forever. Here's one. It's a 636 area code.
Hey, Joe. Mike Minahan here. How you doing?
Hey, Mike. How's it going?
Doing great. Yeah, I'm doing your rent-to-own program in California, and I'm having I'm getting the homeowners to agree to do the rent-to-own, but they are asking ridiculous amounts of money for the houses. They're basically asking for what the house was worth 2 years ago.
How
do you suggest I overcome that?
Well, we've been doing it a couple of ways, because I've got guys that are doing it in California. And I if you're watching the cash flow stuff, let's see, what did I send out recently? I think it's been 5 or 6 months maybe, but I had a guy up in Sacramento that was doing this. Did you get that audio, Scott?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Listen to that again.
Okay.
Because that's got a lot of good stuff in there about selling properties that are upside down.
Right.
A lot of times, though, the buyers are not price sensitive, they're monthly payment sensitive.
Okay.
So I just had just a few weeks ago, Arrow, a guy in LA that I've got, one of my mentor students in LA, sold a property for about $100,000 more than it was worth. That was what the seller owed on the property.
Right.
It was actually worth $100,000 less than what he sold it for, and he actually was $110,000 because he made $10,000 for himself.
Right.
And the buyers were okay with that. See, the buyers are not necessarily looking at it as getting the best deal. They're looking to get into a house and not just a rental property, but into their own home.
Uh-huh.
And so the value is, and the thing that we sell more than anything, first of all, is that it's the monthly payment. So where else can they get into a $400,000 property for $1,500 a month? They can't do that if they got a mortgage. But they can get into a lease option that way, and they can call it their home. And, eventually, if the values go up, they'll be able to buy that property. Now, if the values don't go up, then they've lost their lease option fee, which, is not that huge. I mean, we're looking at less than $10,000 on average in these, typically between 7 and 15 is what we're seeing on lease option deals in California.
Right.
So I don't think that it would be that big of a deal. For you to just to market it that way.
Right. Okay.
Have you tried doing that?
I want to protect my buyers too. I don't want them to not be able to buy because the house didn't come up, and even though they went to the lender and could qualify, they just can't qualify because the house doesn't appraise for, the higher value. So.
Right. Well, they know that, they have to know that going in, and it doesn't hurt to tell them, look, it's not going to qualify right now. You're going to be paying extra for this because you're buying it on terms. You know, if you could afford, or if you had good credit and you could afford a, 10% down payment and do a conventional deal, you wouldn't even be talking to me.
Right.
But But the loans out there to buy properties for people in your situation, they don't exist anymore. So you have to have perfect credit. You have to have full qualifying to be able to go out and get a loan, unless you do an FHA. And even FHA is getting more difficult these days. So if that's the case, then you have to decide, does it make more sense for you to rent, or does it make more sense for you to buy on a rent-to-buy in a situation like this, and potentially be able to eventually exercise that option, but potentially maybe not. You know, right now, the seller, his main goal is to try to fill that property and make his payments.
Right.
Your main goal is to have a house that you can live in. So this is the only way that we can do it that makes sense for both of you. Does that make sense for you? Or does it make more sense for you to go get an apartment? And right. And then they can decide. And a lot of the people, they're calling you because they want a house for their family. They want a house that they can call their home to their friends. Say, no, this is my house. That's a huge, huge thing for people that are buying rent to buy.
Yeah.
It's a huge thing for everybody, really. I mean, everybody wants to be able to say they live in their, they own their own house. There's pride in that.
Right.
That's the American dream. And we can give that to them, at least for that time. And if you're honest with yourself, if you look at people that buy, even with conventional mortgages, they don't stay in their houses more than 2 to 5 years anyway, on average. So are they really owning that property? Certainly not. They've got a mortgage.
Yeah.
So, but they are getting use from it, and they're paying for that use during that time. And some of them are getting better deals, and some of them are not. People that get conventional loans and they're able to qualify and they're able to buy them, and then they turn around and try to sell them later, even during a good market. But, you know, when the market's not going crazy, jumping up like it was, artificially increasing like it was, a lot of times if you bought a new house, you were paying top dollar for that new house, and then you tried to sell it in 2 years, you couldn't sell it without coming to closing with money. So are those people in worse shape than somebody who paid a little bit of money up front and then was able to walk away from that property, or are they in worse shape?
Yeah.
You know, so I think there's a good argument, a good ethical argument, to say this makes sense for a lease option buyer to buy it this way. And I think if you explain it to them with these examples, it'll help them accept it.
Yeah.
They just need to be able to explain it to their friends and to themselves.
Right. Yeah, I just want to let you know, too, that for everybody that's listening, that I am in California and in several other states, but it does work on the high end. I've currently got a 900,000-plus house right now in California.
Nice.
I'm a rent-owned. So,
nice.
Yeah. One of the problems I'm having, I'm sure a lot of other people listening have the same problem as I do, is getting the homeowners to get those lease option memos back to me. So do you have any suggestions?
Yes. Because, and again, I see everybody learning this process. And once you get really good at it, you're not going to have that problem. Huh. But at the beginning, what I suggest is that you go out and meet with them. And you say, well, I need to see the house anyway. Why don't I just come over there? I'll meet you. And you go out to the house. You take your sign. You take your lockbox. You take the lease option memo. And you whip it out and have them sign it.
Yeah.
It's
sort of hard to do because I'm out of state. So.
Okay. So you need to learn how to do it over the phone then, right?
Yeah.
So then don't let them off the phone till you go over it with them. Don't even send it to them
right. Until
you go over it with them on the phone. One of the things that we've done is, I've just got this, one-page lease option memo that, I need you to sign that helps me, that makes it legal for me to do this. By the way, you have to have that if you don't have a license to be legal. So I'm gonna send that over to you. But before I do, I want to just go over it with you real quick to make sure you understand it. And then you ask them, you read through it with them, and you ask them, do you have any questions about it? Do you understand what this is? Is this something you want to do? And
Yeah. Reconfirm
with them and get them to say, yes, it's something I want to do. If they just say, I'll just send it over. A lot of times what they're doing is saying, I want to get you off the phone as quickly as possible. I'm not interested in what you have to say.
Yeah.
And if that's what they're saying, then you'll never get them to call you back or return your call or take your call when you try to call them.
Yeah.
Even though they'll promise you the world, saying, yeah, I'm going to call you back, or, oh, yeah, I'm ready to go. You need to make sure they're ready to go before you send it over to them. Otherwise, they won't sign it and send it back. And one of the things I've got for the push-button people and for the mentor students is an online lease option memo. So you can actually have them go to your website And there's the lease option memo online. They'll have to just fill it out and hit send, you know, which this is my seller, this is my signature, you know, electronic signature, and it'll send it to you, and that'll be a legal a way of doing it.
Yeah, I actually have your push button method, but I didn't see that online form, so.
If you, do you have the stuff up online? Or are you using it?
Yes, I am.
Okay, send me an email, and I'll send it to you.
Okay.
Because it may not be in that disk. It's more recent edition.
Yeah. I also wanted to thank you very much because your Cash Flow Secrets newsletter, it's got a lot of great stuff, and I you know, it's so cheap, it's ridiculous. So for what you, the value to give.
Thank you. I appreciate the positive.
Yeah, it's excellent. I've learned quite a bit of stuff there. So.
Well, it sounds like you're kicking butt there to getting things going. So, congratulations on that.
Yeah. Well, one thing, I'm very strong on the phone, and I tell the people that, you know, I will need to go ahead and read the you know, the lease option memo to them over the phone because I'm required by my attorney.
Right.
And I am. My attorney says read it to him. So,
right.
Yeah. So I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's a California kind of mentality or what, but I'm not having that problem in other states. I'm just having it right now, you know, in California. So.
Where do you live?
I live in Chesterfield, Missouri.
Okay. And why aren't you, are you doing it in Chesterfield?
No.
Why not?
Just trying to keep a low profile.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, the reason being, now I'll say it over the phone anyway. Victim of ID theft, and it cost me over $64,000. So.
Ouch.
Yeah. So I do not, you know, don't want that to happen again.
There are some ways to protect yourself, you know, and keep a shield between you and your marketing.
Yeah.
You know, and if you look for those, I won't get into them here. It's just, but there are some things you can do to keep your name out of your ads and have a protected phone number and all those things that it won't lead back to you.
Yeah.
Until you actually talk to the people.
Yeah, because just like your name, my name's on the website, so.
Yeah. Now, I put my name and phone number and it's a mailing address. It's not my home number or home address, but it's all there, you know, and I don't have too many problems. Every once in a while I get some wacko, but, you know, nobody too bad.
Yeah, I don't know how they got my ID, you know, information, but they just totally wiped out my bank account. So.
Mm. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That's a...
And you know, right now, the, you know, ID theft is just rampant out there on the Internet, so...
Right. Well, you know, what I would do is protect yourself, you know, find some ways to protect yourself, and then get back to work, you know, and not worry about that kind of stuff, because whatever you do, when you're in business, you are going to be a target at some point, and eventually somebody's going to sue you for something, somebody's going to be on you for something, but the less you have, the less likely it is that you're going to get hammered. The more you have, the more you have to protect yourself. But as you go along, you'll learn more how to protect yourself. So, although having your bank account empty doesn't sound like any fun to me. But my guess is that it didn't come from somebody that saw your ad.
Well, I'm hoping, but I really don't know. So,
I mean, try that LifeLock thing. I've heard that that's the thing that works.
Actually, that guy, it's funny that that guy, the president, actually was a victim right after that of ID theft.
Was he?
Yep.
But he got his insurance, but he got, they, did he insure himself or what?
Well, I don't know, but I mean, he was a victim of ID theft right after he said, I dare you to come, you know, steal my ID.
Right.
And somebody did, so.
Yeah, you don't put that dare out to internet hackers, man.
They'll
take you up on it, and they will be good at it.
Yeah.
I'm sure he did not think of everything but they thought of.
I don't think so, but yeah.
Oh, well.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much, Joe.
You bet. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mike. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, let's see who else I've got here. Bill from Kentucky, are you still, did you still have a question?
Yeah, Joe, how you doing?
Good, good.
Just a comment for Mike, if I could.
Okay.
You know, he might want to consider, I'm originally from California, we used to do this years ago. In fact, you and I were out there about the same time together. Anyway, what we used to do is actually give the
lease option buyer credit for the pay down on the loan, as little as it may be, and that was another way of them building up some equity in the deal along the way, right, in return for them coming in and taking over the seller's payment.
But that only works if the seller actually has equity. See, if they owe, let's say they owe $300 and the value is $250, they need to sell it for $300. Otherwise, they're going to have to come to closing with $50,000.
No, I understand that. But what I'm saying is if the buyer's stepping in and making the, you know, the monthly payments or whatever the monthly payments happen to be, you know, a certain percentage of that payment every month is going towards, you know, the loan reduction. So in other words, even if they're upside down, if it's only $500 a month, at the end of the first year, there's $6,000 reduction in the loan amount, and that should be able to essentially reduce the price to the buyer, the lease buyer.
Yeah, that makes sense. So, but they have to make sure they know how much it's being reduced by every month as well, which is usually maybe 10% of the payment if it's early in the amortization.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, certainly that's an advanced technique,
right?
You know, but that's one of the ways to get around that. In other words, what we used to do is that we had that same situation in the 80s, you know, where it wasn't as bad as today, but we still had that situation.
Yes, I remember.
Yes, I know you do.
Yeah.
And so that was one of the ways that we got the buyers to buy onto the deal,
right?
Because they were actually getting whatever loan reduction there was on the loan, it was a credit to the buyer. And so, you know, maybe they were upside down $50,000 when they took over the deal, you know, and maybe 5 years later, maybe that was only a $25,000 deal where they're upside down because they got credit for the loan reduction for a 5-year term.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Although it's probably not going to be those big of numbers. It's going to be a much smaller number. When doing rent credits can be very positive. And you have to. And if you talk to my buddy Jim, who's doing this in Chicago, he'll do rent credits all day long because he feels that that's pretty standard practice there where he's at, and people kind of expect it. Whereas I don't like to do rent credits, not just because it gives them money, but I think that it's kind of artificial. You know, if we say, okay, let's say you're coming up with $1,200 a month on your payment, we're going to give you $200 a month credit towards the purchase of the property, and. And if we've offered that seller, unless we're going to give you $150,000 for the property, and we're going to add, you know, the lease option fee on top of that, and then we're going to take the lease option fee, you're still going to get $150,000. So, and we're going to give them the $200 tax credit. We need to add that tax credit onto the price as well. So now, if I do $200 a month over a year, that's $2,400 I have to add to the price, which is the way most of this is done. Most of these credits are done through raising the price.
So,
you know, that makes sense, but it's also, you know, it's. I guess that, you know, to me, I'd rather just explain it to the buyer and say, look, there's two ways I can do this. One is I can just charge you $1,200 a month and give you that for $150, or I can raise it up to $152,400 and charge and give you a $200 credit. Either way works for me, you know, and that's how it's being done. They're just not telling you that they're doing it.
Right. Well,
and when you tell buyers it that way, a lot of times they'll accept it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. And you know what? All I was saying is, just in that one situation where Mike was having the objection, you know, from the buyers, then you know maybe he pulls that out of his toolbox and he offers that,
right,
you know, as part of the deal and to get them over the top of the hump to do the deal,
right,
but not offer that initially.
Right. Just keep in mind, though, that if it's a $50,000 spread, you're not going to get to $50,000 for many years.
Oh, absolutely. It might be 10 years,
yeah.
You know, so, yeah. But, you know, if it even only turned out to be $10,000 in the next 5 years, that's still $10,000 to the good that they got a credit for that
exactly.
They wouldn't normally get.
Exactly.
That's my only point,
exactly.
Is that we're really talking about psychology here, and we're talking about a way of just pushing the buyer over the edge to get him to do the deal, by sweetening the pot just a little bit.
Yeah, that's an excellent observation. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, the other question I had, Joe, is, you know, we do a lot of mailings to expired listings. You know, we have access to the MLS, and, you know, we're not getting a really good return on that. So what suggestions would you have, you know, in dealing with expired listings?
Are you doing mailings to them?
Yeah, we have a two-letter campaign that we do to them. Okay. That one letter, you know, builds on the other letter, and it's specifically geared and written for expired listings.
Are you using my letter?
No, I don't think we use your. I think we use another series of letters that we picked up along the way.
Typically, my letter gets about an 8% response in almost every place we've ever tried it.
Okay.
As far as yes, you know, and what is your letter? What's it focus on?
Karen, do you have one of those letters nearby? The expires? Okay. Well, it just basically says, you know, it focuses on the fact the realtor didn't do the job, and, you know, we're cash buyers, we're principal cash buyers, and we can buy their property quickly, give us a call, basically is what the essence of the letter says.
Right. You know, one of the things that my letter says is we don't even talk about the listing. Rather than going, I think that's going in a negative direction, honestly. And
okay. They
already know that they didn't succeed. They know that their agent didn't succeed. I'm not going to beat them up or their agent up. Instead, focus on what we do. And we said, we'll make an offer on your property. We're not, you know, we're not agents. We're not attorneys. We are actual buyers. I buy 3 to 5 properties, you know, every month. I'm the most serious buyer you'll ever come across. You know, I buy properties on terms. I'm an investor. And I promise you that no matter what, I'll make an offer on your property. You know, whether you can accept that offer or not is up to you. But I promise I'll make an offer. If you're interested, please give me a call. So as along those lines is how our letter is written. So that when we get these calls back, and then, of course, we take them through that buyer profile sheet, asking them all those questions. And then we analyze the deal, find out, you know, where on the hierarchy of structures that it fits. Is it subject to? Is it multi-mortgage? Is it land contract? Is it, you know, the lease option? Should we do a for-rent deal on it? Do we need to do a undervalued cash offer that's assignable? You know, what type of deal makes the most sense? What's going to solve their problem and make us money? And that's the process that we take everybody through, and we can make everybody. That's the beauty of understanding these structures. Once you understand them, you can make an offer to every single person you talk to. Now, it may not be an offer that they can accept, but it's an offer nonetheless, and it doesn't have to be a cash offer, and you don't have to offer them cash to make it work. Matter of fact, we rarely offer cash, although I've been doing that more with some of these little cheap properties because they've been making a lot of sense. But so did I answer the question, or did I go off on a tangent?
No, it was an excellent answer. Okay. Now, is your expired listing letter in push-button method?
Yes.
Okay. I'll find it, and we'll start using it.
If you can't find it, send me an email, and I'll send it to you.
Okay. Joe, thank you. That's that was a great answer. I appreciate it very much.
You bet. Good luck with it.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. All right. Let's see who else we've got here. Bill, you're still coming up as with a hand raise. Is that an accident, or is that...
That's an accident.
Okay.
Sure. Well, while I've got you on the phone, can I ask you something?
You bet.
Did I understand you on the CD one time saying that you could rent to own a fixer-upper if it needed work on it?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I discovered that by doing rehabs, because we used to do rehabs, and as we were doing them, we would have them for sale for full price. You know, the final price after then, but we'd never promise that we were going to finish the work. And we started selling these properties before we were done with them for full price. And we didn't have to spend the money to finish them. So that led me to think, well, maybe we can do this with the for rent deal, too. So we would advertise them rent to buy, and we right under that we put fixer-upper and no qualifying and move in today. And then when people would call, We would make it very clear to them that these properties are we'd say they're in terrible condition. You know, it smells like a dog. You're going to walk in there, you're going to be gagged by the smell. You know, you're going to have to do a lot of work to this property. If you don't have the skills to do the work, you don't want to move into this property. And this is even if they just had bad carpet. You know, if they were much worse than that, then we'd even go on and on about them. But if they just had even just bad carpet, we'd tell them how horrible it was. That way, when they walked into the property, they'd go, this isn't so bad. You know, we can have it clean. We can change the carpet. And it would change their whole perspective on it. if you don't tell them it's terrible and they go in, it will be terrible to them because right. they're looking at other things that are available that are in good condition. And you also put on there it's a fixer-upper, so there's no, you're setting expectations low to start with. And it doesn't really reduce the amount of people that will actually go look at it. If it's in the area and they like the way it looks on the outside, they'll go inside.
Well, can I ask you something? So, you know, they don't, now these houses are not, I mean, they're not priced in any stretch of the imagination, but are they going to balk at saying, well, you know, why am I paying this down? Because I'm going to need that for sheetrock and paint and blah, 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 you know. Do you just sell that? Do you just sell around it?
There's two ways that you do it. One is, okay. if it's, let's say there's no furnace in the house, and they're doing it as a rent-to-buy. If they move in there with no furnace, they call the health department and you're in trouble, and you're going to have to put a furnace in there for them. You don't want that situation to happen. So instead of collecting a lease option fee, let's say they're going to give you $4,000 for the lease option, and you know a furnace is going to cost $1,500. So what you have them do is before they move in, they put the furnace in, they give you the rest, the other $2,500 comes to you, and then they move in and they can take over the property. They've done the furnace work, they've paid for it, it's in there. Now if it's just a cosmetic issue, like a bad carpet or bad paint, and they're going to do that later, sheetrock, whatever, that stuff they can move into the property and do the work so they can give you the down payment and they can come up with the money later to do that. But if it's a habitability issue, then you don't want to rent to somebody that's a habitability problem. Now, with that said, if you got a problem property that's a habitability issue problem, I bought some properties in Detroit.
I saw the pictures.
I mean, these houses have no furnace, no plumbing, no kitchens. You know, I paid $1,000 to $2,500 for these things. So what we did was I sold them on a land contract. That way I don't have to worry about them being tenants, and I don't have to take care of them as tenants. They have to go in and fix them themselves. So I sold them for $1,000 down and $20,000, $250 a month, and I sold, you know, a bunch of them that way, and that's working out pretty well. We still have to collect the rent and all or the payments, but they pay for themselves in 6 months. So it's not, 10 months, whatever. It's paid for, so you don't have to worry about it very much.
Okay. And one last question, I'll leave you alone. Two questions. So, cosmetics okay, mechanicals not. I didn't understand all you were saying about
cosmetics. It's okay. They give you the down. They give you the lease option fee, and they move in, and they can do the work at their own pace.
Okay.
You know, and remember, you're selling it to them for full market value. You're not discounting the price just because it's a fixer upper. Sell it to them for full market value.
See, that just blows my mind.
See, and that's because you're not into the heads of the lease option buyers. The lease option buyer is interested in their monthly payment, not so much their payment. That's how we're able to sell properties for $50,000, $100,000, $200,000 more than they're worth in California, because they're interested in the monthly payment, not the purchase price.
Okay.
And also, 30% or less will actually exercise a lease option. It's not very likely that they're going to exercise that option anyway.
Right.
If they do, you want to make sure you get top dollar for it. If they don't, it's okay. You'll just put another tenant in there later.
Okay. Okay, my last question. A realtor that I trust immensely, she's been sending me all these leads in nice areas, nice houses, said they're open to rent to own, you know, that she did a search, and she's sending everything to me. But she said there's no way that she can, you know, I said, well, how do you and I get paid? And basically she told me it's just going to be out of the kindness of their heart if I got anything. So needless to say, I haven't pursued anything. Is there any, so it's either a fee, it's either a lead fee or a finder's fee or something like that?
You mean as far as her paying you?
Well, are the buyer paying her to pay me or however?
She can represent you in the transaction. So she can become the middle person in the transaction, assuming she wants to do the work and get paid for it. And by the way, for anybody who's on the call who's an agent, this is something you can do personally. You don't have to go find an agent to do that. But what that makes it possible for you to do is advertise homes rent to buy, bring those people into your office, make sure they've got, verify their funds, make sure they've got money for the down payment, for the lease option fee, and then pull up all the properties that are listed for rent, all the houses that are listed rent to buy in the MLS, listed by other agents, and let them go look at those properties and tell them, look, not every one of these we're going to be able to make a deal with, but some of them we will. So what I want you to do is find two or three of them that you like. You know, drive around, look at all these properties that are available. I'll put you on the list so you get them as they come out. And then when you find one that you like, and you can expand this, by the way, not just to ones that advertise rent to buy, but to every property in the MLS, it's more likely that somebody who's been on the market for 3 or 4 or 5 months is more likely to do than somebody who's been on 2 weeks if they're trying to get cash. But you can expand it to all those people. Then you can make an offer when the time comes, and you can go to them and say, this is what the offer is, and you can offer them full price. And then you can have, and this is the lease option fee that's being paid by the buyer, and it's going to me, their agent, not to the other agent. You know, usually in a real estate transaction, the listing agent is the one that pays the co-op fee. But in this situation, it's the buyer's agent who's bringing in somebody with a fee, and they're going to keep it all themselves. And if they exercise the option, they're also going to get a percentage, their real estate percentage commission, which I wouldn't hold my breath as to getting, but it's possible. On top of that, there's probably a co-op fee being paid by the listing agent of a few hundred dollars. They usually pay half a month's rent or something like that. That's pretty standard in most areas.
Do I need to ask her to represent me?
She essentially, what you would be doing is going out there advertising rent-to-buy homes and then qualifying those people and then giving them to her. And then she goes out and helps them find a property. And you show her how to do that and how she can make money doing it and how to make the offer making that happen. And then she gives you half of the deal as a lead fee or as an employee fee or whatever. You can't show properties for her.
Right.
Otherwise, because you don't have a license. You can go out and get a license and do that, but I wouldn't recommend going out and getting a license. You know,
yeah.
Nothing wrong with getting a license. It actually can help you, but it distracts you from starting your business.
Well,
and by the way, this is also an advanced technique that you use once you know how to talk to people and do this stuff. Don't do this at the beginning. Because it's you learn how to put deals together on your own, how to automate your own business, how to make all that stuff happen. Then, when you talk to an agent, you'll be talking on a little higher level, and you'll be coming at them knowing how to do it. If you're coming at it from speculation, and here's how Joe told me how to do it, you know, I've never done it myself, they're going to have a harder time believing that.
Right.
But if you had already done it, and you've already got a system set up, and you're doing stuff, and you're bringing leads in, and then you can funnel leads to her as well, and she can pay you a lead fee. She can't pay you a referral if you don't have a license. That's against their rules.
Okay. Thank you, Joe.
All
appreciate
right.
It.
Good luck with it.
Thank you.
Let's see. Going to somebody else here. Ah, is this Karen? Karen?
No, it's me again.
Oh, wait a second. Karen, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay.
Yay! Woo!
How are you doing?
Hi, Joe. I'm doing great. How are you?
Good.
This call has been amazing, and your newsletter is unbelievable. It's worth a lot more than, 39? It's I really learned a ton. I've learned more from you in less, 60 days than I've learned from any other realtor, broker, anything. So kudos to you. But I did have a couple questions.
You tell them I'm not paying you to say that.
No, you're not paying me to say that. You are not paying me to say that. And, you know, the funny thing, I have brokers who've been doing investment real estate in Detroit for, you know, broker friends for 25, 30 years who weren't even aware of some of the things that I've shared with them. And they're like, what?
Yeah,
72?
Yeah.
Or putting properties in trust or what? I haven't done anything. Thing like that, but that's my question. I'm wondering, could I do a subject to property and then turn around and land contract it?
Oh yeah.
You're kidding.
No, that's the whole hierarchy of that zero down structure. You know, subject to, when you buy subject to, you've got the deed, so you can do anything with it. You know, subject to that existing loan. So if you want to sell that property on land contract, you can do that, and that keeps you in control of it. And that's exactly. You know, that's what I was doing with those houses in Detroit, where I actually bought them, and I got the deed to them, and then I was selling them on land contract. It doesn't matter whether I had an existing loan on it, as long as I sell it on land contract for less than what I owe on it, I'm okay. If you try to sell it for more than or less than what you owe on it, then and you have to come to closing, you know, if they decide to pay it off, you'd have to come to closing with extra money. You don't want to do that.
Okay. And then, so I can do that. Okay, I didn't know that. See? And I have a real estate license.
Yeah.
It's kind of scary. But I'm wondering, when you try to, let's say someone has a mortgage, and I've encountered a lot of people here in Detroit who do have mortgages. They are upside down, and they're afraid that by doing a land contract, it's going to trigger the due on sale. And I read in the September newsletter that you can put the property in a trust.
Yeah. Don't mess with a trust, though. You know, the due on sale clause, yeah, it doesn't get triggered. I've done this hundreds of times. It's never been triggered before. Now, I'm not saying that it can't be or that it won't be for you, because it might.
Then what do I do?
But it's never happened to me before. Now, let's look at worst-case scenario. What if it did happen? And let's say they sell the property to me, and let's say it's a $150,000 property. It's got a $140,000 mortgage on it, and I take it. They deed it to me, and they deed it to my corporation. And suddenly the bank or the mortgage company gets in a snit and they decide that they're going to foreclose on that property because we've broken the agreement with them. And by the way, you're not breaking the law, you're breaking a contract. Two very different things. So you're not doing anything illegal by doing this. So you take now you've got the deed and they decide, oh, I want we're going to have to foreclose because we only accept payments from the person who took the loan out. So we say, well, okay, take the property back.
You would give it back to the original mortgager?
I give it to the, you know, I tell the bank, it's okay, you can take it back. Do you want it? And they always say, no. Go ahead and make the payments. We'll accept them. That's been...
Really?
And if you look at how many properties are in foreclosure right now, and if you look at what foreclosure does to a bank, banks have credit reports just like we do. And the more foreclosures they have, the more properties they have, non-performing assets, the less likely it is they can get secondary funds, you know, from the secondary market. So they can't make loans if they have too many of those. So for them to take on another foreclosure just because they're pissy about it, it doesn't make sense. So instead, what they'll do is they'll accept the payments. And I used to, you know, do things to kind of hide that process. And I thought, because I thought, well, you know, this could happen. But we've done it for so long and with so many different properties, and it's never happened, that I finally just switched over. We make the payments directly from my corporation. We write the loan number on there. We always send in the payment stub, and they accept our payment. And every once in a while, they'll come back and say, no, we can't accept this payment from you. We have to get it from the seller. We'll say, are you sure you want to do that? And they always back down. Now,
okay.
Is there a time that they might say, no, we'll take it back? If I give it back to them, I've lost nothing. It may screw up the buyer's credit, and I go back to the buyer, or I'm sorry, the seller's credit.
Seller.
And
I
go back to them and say, hey, do you want this property back? Do you want to start making payments? They're not going to let me do it anymore. And that seller would say, no, I can't. That's why I sold it to you. It's going to have to go into foreclosure. So then, you know, does the bank back down at some point? And my experience has been that they back down very quickly. And usually it doesn't even become an issue.
Okay, so it's basically the philosophy you're saying is as long as that loan is performing, they're getting payments, why would they foreclose?
Exactly. There's no upside to them. Now, the only upside, let's say it's a small little bank, and it just comes to the attention of the bank president that there's a property out there that has a $50,000 mortgage on it, and he knows it's worth $300,000. And he just realizes that they have defaulted because they've got the due on sale clause, they transferred it. First of all, if you get a deal like that, you're doing really good, and you could turn around and sell it on the MLS before he could foreclose on it. But let's say you couldn't do that, and he wanted to try to get that capital out of you, then it might actually happen. But you're probably never going to be in that situation.
Okay. And then my other question, what's reasonable, because what I'm encountering in terms of doing the land contracts with this tax credit, I'm kind of getting resistance because they're thinking, oh, you know, they're not sure that the tax credit money is going to come back. And they want what I consider exorbitant down payments from my buyer. For example, you know, on a $70,000 house, they want 14,000, you know, 20%.
Right.
And I'm thinking a moderate income person probably doesn't have $14,000 to put down. How do you what's a good way, or what are some techniques to kind of put the seller at ease, that they're, because they're afraid that they'll let someone in their home, they won't perform, and they got to go through the whole eviction process.
Right.
Because they don't have a lot of money down.
Were they thinking about renting it, or were they just thinking about selling it?
I'm approaching them as land contracts.
So, but originally, I mean, the way you originally got a hold of them, they were thinking about selling it on the MLS?
They had the houses for rent.
For rent.
The people I'm approaching that had the houses for rent, and I figure, why not sell it?
First of all, they already know that if they got it for rent, that there's the possibility or even likelihood that they'll have to do an eviction at some point.
That's true. Okay.
So this isn't really that much difference. You do a judicial foreclosure on a land contract. So it doesn't take as long as a full-blown foreclosure.
Okay.
So it's you know, is it a little bit more difficult? Sometimes. But it's not that big of a deal. And they have more to lose because, you know, if you're doing the tax credit money, let's say you sold it for $80,000 and you get the $8,000 from the tax credit and you give them half and you keep half of it for your fee, then if those people don't make those payments for 3 years in a row, then the IRS is going to come after them for that $8,000. They're not going to come after you guys. They're going to come after them. So there's a big hammer being held over their head to make sure they make their payments. But worst case scenario is you have to get rid of them and dump, you know, and take them through that process. Now, if you're using the documents that I've shown you with the deed back to you, then even that gives you a little bit of strength. So you've got the land contract, and then you have them sign a deed back to you so that you can take that property back. Now, again, I don't know if that's enforceable in a court of law, but it's usually enforceable simply because you've got it. And then you can show it to them and say, look, this says you have to move out, and you've agreed to move out. If this situation occurred. And, you know, on my documents, you have all sorts of disclosures and, you know, I agree to this and all that stuff, you know, that protect us.
Okay. All righty. Well, those are my only questions for today.
Are you having luck finding the buyers for these properties?
I am. I've found actually a ton of buyers, and I'm not the most organized person. That's probably a whole separate conversation about how to organize, because I don't have the push button thing on my own. Obviously, Arrow is setting it all up.
Well, don't worry about that so much. What I think would be good for you at this point is to take those buyers, because you got the license, bring them into the office. Pull up the properties that fit their needs. Yeah, and you know the criteria that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So you pull up the properties that that fit their needs and that still work for, you know, the investors that you're working with. And find them properties that your investor can buy for them and do it that way.
Okay.
Because
all right.
You understand what I'm saying, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Because I think that's going to be... first of all, verify they got the money. Make sure they got the $1,000 or $2,000 or whatever. They don't need very much, and make sure that they're ready to go. And then get them into the office. Get them the properties that are available, because there's lots of them that fit this criteria. So
right.
Get them the properties that are available. Let them go out and look at them. As soon as they see the ones, you know, two or three that they like, take them out and show them to them. And then you know, we'll put the deal together that way.
Okay. Because I feel like my buyers are like rabbits right now.
Yeah, which means that when you have so many leads like that, which I'm assuming what you're saying is that you have a lot of them, right?
No. Yeah.
Okay.
And they're all.
I guess rabbits could be taken
place.
In different ways, but if you got lots of leads, it really puts you in control, because then you could tell them exactly what you need them to do. In your case, you need them to verify their funds. You need to have them come into the office and sit down with either you or with your assistant and pull up the properties that fit the criteria that they need. You need to explain to them how you work and how the process works and, you know, get them the property, talk to the investor, get that thing put together, get the deal closed. And I think that'll be the way that you get these people going. I think that there's so many opportunities right now, you know, with as many buyers as you've got. And, you know, yeah, I mean, you know how to generate those buyers like crazy.
Yeah.
You just use the stuff that I'm teaching. So, you know, if you get that going and then tell them what they need to do to make your job easier, they'll do it. Because you got, or at least a certain percentage of them will. And those are the ones you have to work with. Only are the ones you have to work with, because everybody else, you know, you don't have time for them. and you don't need right. them because you got so many leads. You know, if you had three leads, that'd be different. You'd do a lot more work. But since you know how to put together these leads, you don't have to do nearly as much work.
Okay. All righty. Well, good deal. I'm going to Huntington. I'm almost there.
Okay.
I didn't go to the mall on you.
Okay, sounds good.
All right, Joe. Thank you.
Thanks, Karen. Talk to you soon.
Okay. Bye-bye. Okay. Bye-bye.
All right. Well, we're going a little bit over time here, but it looks like I've... let me check to see if we've got anybody else who's still got their hand raised. And I'll take the question if there are. This thing refreshes so slowly. Okay, I'm going to take two more questions. I'll drag it out a little bit here. Let's see. This is from area code 781. Who's on the line?
Hi, Joe.
Hey.
Jim Campbell here in Massachusetts.
Hey, Jim. Jim, did you say?
Jim, right.
Jim, okay, how you doing?
Good, very good, thank you. I just want to thank you for all your emails back to me as we're getting prepared to buy Push-Button Method and all your good wishes with my recovery from my quadruple bypass this year. And all the encouragement that I got from you and from Carol. That was Carol, your mom?
Yes.
Yes, yes. I emailed her back as well. And just wanted to say thanks. And we're looking forward to moving forward. However, we had an unexpected auto repair. So we're going to have to take care of the vehicle. And we're going to be looking forward to buying Push-Button Method beginning of November.
Excellent. Yeah, I'm actually working on an upgrade of the Push-Button Method. So... we're going to, hopefully that'll be done in the next month or so. Got some new stuff to add to it.
I just can't thank you enough, Joe, even though we haven't gone into full swing here, but restarting the newsletter. And, you know, we had a problem down at the bank. The bank made a deposit into one of the wrong accounts. Carol took care of that right away. And it's just nice to know that there's somebody out there that's real.
Well, thank you for that. I wish you all the best and hope you're feeling better soon, too.
Doing great. Thank you very much, and take good care to all of you.
All right. Thanks, Jim.
Bye.
Bye-bye. All right. This next area code, if it opens up, is 323. Who do I got there?
Hello?
Yes.
Hi, Joe.
Hey, who's this?
This is Ray in Los Angeles.
Hey, Ray. How you doing?
Great. How are you? Well, my question to you, I've been getting your material for the past few months now, and I have the Stupid Proof program, obviously a cash flow member. Great stuff, by the way.
Thank you.
And first question, you know, it's more of a beginner question, but just want to be sure that I'm on the right track here. So as far as the for rent method is concerned, when you are doing the contracts with the seller, and the only one, obviously, is the lease option memo. Am I also doing a purchase agreement and between me and the seller?
Which program do you have in mind?
The Stupid Proof.
Okay. Send me an email, and I'll send you the new documents.
Okay.
If you've got one of my packages, even the Push Button or the Stupid Proof, send it to me. I've revised the lease option agreement, and I've gotten it down to two documents now.
Okay.
Normally what I did was we had a purchase agreement, we had an option agreement, we had an assignment agreement, we had a disclosure agreement, so we had four different documents. Now I've got it down to two, where everything is included in those two things.
And that's just between myself, the principal, and the seller?
There's two documents. One of them is between the seller, the new buyer, and yourself. That's the assignment form. And then the what I call the resident documents are between the seller and the new buyer. The lease option agreement memo, that was the original thing that you signed between you and the seller.
Correct.
That's never seen by the new buyer, because that's going to be a different price than what they're going to get, because you're adding on your lease option fee to their to the price.
Okay. Okay, so I'll send you an email and get that new information. That'd be good.
just remind me, I promised you.
No problem.
I'll get it to you.
Also, now, for instance, when put a house under contract and, you know, let's say the tenant buyer does not exercise their option, and is the seller, are they informing you, you know, hey, this person didn't exercise their option? Because, I mean, once that happens and they, the tenant buyer and the seller, once that deal is closed, you're out of the picture, correct?
Right.
So then if they do not exercise their option within the lease term, is the seller, you know, informing you, hey, you know, this person is out, you know, and then are you just starting the process all over again, or how do you...
Exactly. Yeah, you leave it open so that you can fill it for them again. Christy, one of my mentor students, was telling me just the other day she had just filled a property for the fourth time in 2 years, gotten four lease option fees.
So just let the seller know, hey, if they don't want to exercise the option, let me know and I'll fill it for you again.
Yeah, and let them know. So, you know, it's unlikely that that person will exercise the option. As a 30% or less exercise the option.
Right.
You know, we... so, you know, and you can use that argument as a positive thing or a negative thing, but I think normally you just tell them to, this is the reality, you know, but still they usually take better care of the property. They treat it like their own. They're, you know, they're better, usually better tenants. Not always. Sometimes you have to evict them too, but usually it's a better deal. Plus they take care of the property. Our documents are written so that they have to take care of any repairs.
Mm-hmm.
We tell our buyers when they move in, said, look, you got to treat us like Countrywide. You know, we're like Bank of America. We're not your landlord. We're this, the mortgage company. So you're going to make payments to us, even though a judge wouldn't see it that way.
Correct. Okay. Now, another question real quick. If, let's say, you know, you have a 2 or 3 year lease and the market starts to turn around, and I don't know, I'm here in Los Angeles, so, you know, the home prices are quite a bit higher, but either way, wherever you are, let's just round about number 400,000, and that was the agreed upon purchase price for the tenant buyer when they got the home under contract. Now, if the home appreciated, let's say, you know, I don't know, 10%, do they benefit and that turns into equity for the tenant buyer, or can the contract be renegotiated for the seller?
If the seller gives an option at a specific price and the price goes above that price, then it's a benefit to the seller or to the buyer.
To the buyer, okay. Yeah. So they get that instant equity then.
Yes.
Okay.
But that's the chance that they're taking. The likelihood is, in this market, that they're going to sell it for more than it's worth and that it's not going to appraise when they finally try to exercise the option. And then the seller has to decide, do I lower the price in order for them to qualify, or do I not sell it? They don't have to sell it for less than they agreed to.
Okay.
But they do have to sell it for the amount that they did agree to.
All right.
Which for most sellers isn't a problem. In most situations is not going to be a problem.
All right. Well,
anything else you need on that?
No, I think that should answer my questions for now. I mean, if anything else comes up, hopefully I can, the next couple months, get some deals done here and get into your mentor program, which would be ideal.
I tell you, when the people get into the mentor program, it usually kicks them into high gear. Because what I find is that a lot of people are not focused on the things they need to be focused on. They're focused on the things that they enjoy rather than the things that are going to make them money. And it's not always the same thing. So once you learn what's going to make you money and you sit down every day and say, okay, where's the money? You know, you make a list of the things that need to be done. Where's the money on this list? You do those things first. You know, for what I tell them all is the thing that you need to be doing at the beginning when you're just starting is to get cash flow. Cash flow is more important than the long-term investment stuff. You can't have a viable business unless you got cash flow in it. So you got to find a way to make the cash flow. I believe the for rent method is the best way to get cash flow as fast as possible. Now, I tell everybody, give yourself 3 or 4 months before you can expect to make any money at all, and be prepared for that. You know, I've got people that do it in a week, but they're the exception, not the rule. So give yourself the time so that you can learn the process, because there is a learning curve. But it doesn't cost you any money, and you don't have any credit on the line, you don't have any money on the line, and this is a great way to do it, a great way to get going and build a business. And, you know, even if you're just doing a deal a month and making $2,000 or $3,000 or $5,000 a month, that replaces a lot of people's income right there. And if you need to make, you know, $100,000 before you can quit, you know, I've had people that have done that in a fairly short period of time. And, of course, I've had people making much, much more than that. So you know, the mentor program is a great way to help you get going and help you see where you're at right then and there, and to be able to ask questions. Because I find that people will listen to this stuff and they'll understand what I'm saying, but then they'll go off in a completely different tangent because of something they heard before, or something, a question they had, or a concern that they had, or something that didn't work for them that completely kicks them in the butt and makes them think that the whole thing's not going to work, when in fact all they have to do is make one little tweak. And if they would tell me what the problem is, I can say, why don't you do this, or change this, or make this modification, and it'll make a huge difference in the way and the speed that they make money and get their business up and running. So, you know, I know the biggest stumbling block for people is to being able to afford it, because it's an expensive program. But a lot of times they end up, the cost is minuscule compared to the money that they make, as long as they do the work. If they're not going to do the work, there's no reason for them to be in the program.
True. Well, with the information that I do have, I mean, I think for the most part, you know, the front method is pretty simple and straightforward, and just got to, like you say, you know, put the work in and make it happen. Yeah. And
it's just the basics. It's just the beginnings.
Yeah.
Once you get that going, and once you create a system to get that going, it's like the plate spinner at the circus. You get that first plate running, and then you put the second plate on and get that one going. You know, then you start getting into subject two. Then you start getting into land contracts. Then you start getting into working with investors. And you do all these other things as you grow. And it'll turn into this big snowball. I call it the snowball effect, where once you start taking action on some of this stuff, you get overwhelmed. There's just so much stuff to do. And that's when people lose their focus. And that's when they get frustrated, because they don't focus on the things that are going to make them the money. If they would just as the things come in, it starts to build like that. If they learn how to delegate, how to automate, and how to optimize all the stuff they're doing, and learn how to talk to people, learn how to speak on the phone. I mean, again, that's not a talent, talking on the phone. It's a skill that you can learn. And if you go through this process and learn the stuff that I'm teaching, you'll be able to do it. And not just to you, Ray, but to everybody on the call.
Right. Now, Joe, that reminds me real quick, another quick question, just about the buyers. And I think you kind of touched on this a little earlier in the call, where, and I remember listening to it when you had the audio with Scott Schuer,
mm-hmm.
and he mentioned something about, you know, getting his buyers kind of pre-approved for a future mortgage, you know, in, say, 1 to 2 years, like a plan for them to, say, you know, be approved when this, you know, like I said, in a couple of years. And then they'll be ready in that time frame to get an actual mortgage for the house and then exercise that option.
Right.
Is that would you suggest us, you know, sending them, the buyers on our list, to a mortgage broker to get that process started?
I don't think it hurts if you've got a mortgage broker that you can work with and rely upon. One of the things we found is that mortgage brokers are very unreliable when it comes to giving them these kind of leads, because they talk to two or three of them, they realize, hey, these people don't qualify. And they don't. And they won't qualify for a couple of years. That's the whole point. But, you know, eventually they are going to qualify and they're going to need a loan. And if this person had the foresight to pay attention and follow through, then they would make money. But they're not going to make it today. So, and by
that's
the way,
what they want. They want that
exactly.
that loan right now.
Exactly.
Instead of thinking in the future, you know, hey, I can have this come in the future for sure.
So instead of doing that, and by the way, if you're selling a property and you're selling it on a lease option and you want to have it more likely that they'll exercise the option, then you help them get it qualified. Then you're going to get that chunk of money a lot faster. But and you can help them go through that process. You can get them into credit counseling. You can get them with a mortgage person. You can do all those things to help them if you want to. But a lot of times, they're not going to exercise the option even if they do qualify. So let them go through a lot of times, we'll let them just go through the process themselves and do their own thing. If they need help, they can ask us, and we offer the help. So I wouldn't spend too much time on that, because that's not where the immediate money is going to come from.
Right. Okay. You know, I thought about it as far as a way of helping them, and then it might also look better towards the seller, saying, hey, you know, this person is on a path
right.
to get approved, you know.
Absolutely. And but I also, you got to be honest with the sellers too and say, look, 30% or less are going to qualify or going to exercise the option. But that doesn't mean it still doesn't make sense. And then give them all the reasons that it made sense that we've talked about,
mm-hmm.
even on this call.
All right. Sounds good.
All right, Ray.
Well, hey. I appreciate your time and all your instruction to us.
You bet. I wish you the best, and I'll look forward to working with you in the future if you can get into the mentor program.
Sounds good, Joe. Look forward to it, too.
Thanks, Ray.
All right.
All righty. I think that's everybody that has questions. So I'm going to. We've gone a little bit longer than I promised. So I think we'll call it a day. Thanks everybody for coming on the call. I want to encourage each of you to to get involved in my mentor program. I think that's probably the next step for most of you. You might also want to look at the push button method. Be happy to work with you, or at least talk to you about working with you. Make sure that it's right for you if you're interested. All right, everybody. Thank you much. Talk to you soon.